Good morning, and welcome to the April 27th, 2020 meeting of the Chelan County Public Utility District Commission. I'd like to thank everyone for calling in this morning, and in the spirit of social distancing due to the COVID-19 virus, today's meeting will be conducted by telephone. Members of the public that may be on the phone are encouraged to make comments and ask questions. If you do wish to speak, please state your name, your address for the record, and limit your comments to 3 minutes. I will be opening the phone lines for such comments later in today's session. This morning's meeting is a study session, and the business session will start this afternoon at 1 o'clock. Today we have four commissioners, but anticipate five joining us here by phone. General Manager Steve Wright, General Counsel Eric Wahlquist, and Rebecca Garfin, Clerk of the Board, are all on the phone as well. Steve, at this point, would you join me in a Pledge of Allegiance? I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America, one nation, God, visible, liberty, and justice for all. Thank you. So, commissioners, we have a consent agenda ahead of us. Any item is subject from the regular agenda to the consent agenda upon request. Do I hear any such request?
This is Commissioner Smith, and I'd like to suggest item 11 be moved to the consent agenda, as I've seen that one on every year since I've been a commissioner.
Do we hear a second?
Second.
It has been moved and seconded to move item number 11 to the consent agenda. Do we have any discussion? Hearing no discussion, all those in favor, please say aye.
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 Those opposed? The ayes have it. Steve, this is where I'd like to turn the meeting over to you to introduce our CPO winner, please.
Sorry to interrupt. This is Ann. This is Commissioner Congdon. I just was able to get on.
Can you hear me? Good. Thank you, Ann.
Thank you.
Okay, we are pleased to recognize John Sagasser as our monthly Cycle of Personal Ownership Award winner. John has been leading the Rock Island Powerhouse 2 rehabilitation effort to develop a new contract, probably one of the largest contracts that the district will see over the course of this past decade. John was recognized for a variety of things, but I think that for me the key was the recognition from the very beginning. This is a big contract, and it required a lot of engagement across the district. There are lots of different issues that are involved with this contract. And he built a team, built a process that engaged that team, and has been really diligent all the way through the process in terms of assuring that a variety of different views were heard, the opportunity to make sure that we were thinking about not just the financials, not just the engineering component, the safety component, the environmental component. All of these are issues that needed to be addressed, and he's really done a marvelous job at that. So we wanted to take a moment and celebrate John, talk about what a great job that he has done for us, and in particular how he has taken personal accountability and really owned this project from the beginning, and not just from his perspective, but from a district-wide perspective, what creates best value for our customer owners. So John, I'm hoping that you are on the line since you're not in the room. And this is an opportunity for you, if you'd like, to be able to say something to the board.
I will. I'm here on the phone and just wanted to say thank you. Thank you for the recognition. I really appreciate it. I also just wanted to say thank you for the trust. I mean, it is a big project. It's a new process. Using the design-build process has been unique to me as well as to everybody on the team. And it takes speaks volumes to me in your trust of me to be able to lead and handle these this project. So just wanted to say thank you for that.
I'd like to thank John for taking that initiative and shepherding this project. It is a really big deal, and as you pointed out, it's new. It's something new for the district to go down this path, and you've done a wonderful job. We really appreciate the guidance that you've provided on this project. So thank you, John.
Gary, this is Ann.
Yes, Ann.
Hi. Yeah, I wanted to say thank you as well to John. I've kind of watched John from afar for quite a few years, and he is so conscientious and so nice to work with. Such a wonderful attitude. I just appreciate having him, you know, as part of the team. He's terrific. Thanks, John.
Thank you, Ann. Appreciate it.
John, this is Dennis Bowles, and is to echo what Ann and Gary have said to this point, I totally agree. I also had the opportunity to observe you as a family man in a different social setting than probably the other commissioners, and what you see is what you get. You are a good father, an attentive husband, as well as an outstanding employee, and just want to appreciate you for the quality that you bring in your private and public life to the community and to the Chelan County PUD, and thanks for your service and for a job well done and being inclusive and thoughtful of others. Much appreciated.
Thank you, Dennis.
You're welcome.
Well, John, this is Steve. I just want to apologize for the fact that because of COVID, we're not able to have you here in the room. I think it's really nice when we can see you in person and the board can see you in person. But I hope this is at least a bit of a substitute for our normal process. And we look forward to you continuing to do some fantastic work for us.
Well, thank you. This has been very meaningful for me. I really appreciate it. And it is fun and exciting. It's nice to be recognized, and it is nice to be a part of a good team, everybody inclusive. So thank you. Appreciate it.
Okay. With that, commissioners, we're ready to turn to agenda item 4, which is the quarterly district performance plan status update. You know the way we do this, although this is the first time we've tried to do it with so many people on the phone, so we'll be seeing how well we can do it. I go through every item. We go through exceptions, items that are yellow, blue, or red. Hopefully you have the material in front of you. You'll be able to follow along with us. We'll be starting with Mike Coleman.
Okay, thank you. Mike Coleman, Managing Director of Fiber and Telecom. Objective 1, Item B on the first page, the fiber installation service interval. We improved it dramatically over the fourth quarter, but didn't quite make the 10 days. However, just as a heads up and a forward look, with the changes that impacted us from COVID, I would expect that to increase for the second quarter. Thank you.
Steve Wright, I have the second item, which is as we move forward with implementing the strategic plan, we needed to have a senior team strategy session by the end of February. We did complete that and are on track in terms of developing the five-year business plan and budget for 2021.
Mike, again, I've got item F3, the evaluation of the fiber program acceleration that was impacted by the COVID-19 changes. Discussions ongoing, still moving forward, and we will get to an answer shortly.
Good morning. This is Kelly Boyd, Chief Financial and Risk Officer. And on item F4, we did review and revise the public power benefit criteria. However, we completed it just after the end of Q1. So it is completed. However, it was completed after the deadline, so you see it as red.
Good morning, John Stoll, Managing Director of Customer Utilities. I have item H. That's on the customer satisfaction survey. The first one, we did select a consultant, and we're on our way, so that was completed. However, we put the survey on hold. Our plan was to initiate the survey right about the time the shelter-in-place information came forward. But we're looking to pick that up probably over the next quarter.
Good morning, Commissioners. Justin Erickson, Managing Director of District Services. I've got the next one, and it's adopt a long-term management plan for Arondo River Park. I think I had previously reported to you at a recent meeting that we've had good discussions with the Regional Port Authority. Of course, there's been a consolidation that's been in place and approved. And as part of those discussions, it was the management indicated that they'd like to maybe have a little bit more time to evaluate long-term management of Arondo River Park. I felt like getting an entire season under their belt with the current operations would be beneficial. And so what we are contemplating here with this notation is that the long-term management plan may not be presented in 2020, but would rather be completed in 2021.
Next up is Kirk on the Hydropower Research Institute.
Good morning, Commissioners. It doesn't work very well when you're talking on mute. I'm sorry. Managing Director of Generation and Transmission. Next one is item K, Hydropower Research Institute, and colored this one yellow due to COVID-19. We had to cancel a couple of meetings where we had planned to meet with some prospective hydropower owners. It's just difficult to gauge the priority right now, given everybody's focus on the COVID-19 response.
This is Justin again. Under L1, we have a metric here about effectively engaging with the community, particularly at off-site events and locations. And so certainly with COVID-19, that emphasis has shifted, and we've been staff and those opportunities have shifted to our COVID-19 response as the face-to-face engagements have been placed on hold.
Commissioners, this is Greg Carrington, moving on to objective number 2, item F1, the energy efficiency goals of obtaining 2 average megawatts is going to be delayed given the fact that either some of the companies we plan on working with are closed or access has been limited. So we anticipate that we will be meeting our compliance goal, but we probably will not be meeting our stretch goal.
This is Kirk again on item G. We had a goal to return C9 to service. This is a long-term repair on a large unit at Rocky Reach. The goal was to return it to service by February 15th, and that was completed on January 31st. Next, several items here I'm going to pull together. They're all related. It's Rocky Reach trunnion bushing repairs. You see those C2 through 7 listed there. All that work has been temporarily curtailed at least 8 weeks, mainly because we've stopped the planned maintenance and modernization work in each of the powerhouses as part of our risk mitigation strategy for COVID-19. Switching over to Rock Island, got a number of, I'll go through each one of these because there's different explanations for each of the units at Rock Island. The first one being B4. We actually had a goal to return that one to service on May 1, which we won't make. Couple of reasons. One of them is the work was delayed approximately 10 weeks due to discharge liner repairs and delays on the hydraulic power unit. In addition to those delays, it's another 8 weeks of delays due to the COVID-19, at least 8 weeks due to the COVID-19 response. B3, simply that unit doesn't start until we get done with B4, so that's the impact there. B5, disassembly work, we had a goal to start in the first quarter. We actually started ahead of schedule on the disassembly, which ended up being a good thing. And then B7, colored that one caution, just because we're not seeing a lot of impacts other than new bushings that might be coming in, but a lot of the work happening on B7 right now is off-site, so that one hasn't necessarily been impacted other than the supply chain, potentially. And then on B10, that one, we had return to service on April 30th, which we're not going to make. There was an eight-week delay due to the runner delivery to the site, as well as space congestion in the powerhouse. And then, again, the work was delayed at least another 8 weeks due to the COVID-19.
Commissioners, this is John. I'm down under Asset Management M. I have a yellow on identifying all assets that meet a threshold or a criteria. Progress has been made, although some of the finalization has been difficult due to COVID-19.
This is Justin. I've got the next several, and I'm at the top of page 5. 3A, implement asset management strategies and capital improvement plans for boat docks and erosion control projects. So this has a completion date of 12-1, but is yellow because we do anticipate some potential delays in some of those projects. We also have a management analyst position that is open that assists with the asset management process. And we did provide you a presentation on March 16th regarding those capital plans and projects. So, and then the next two are under N, advance the district strategy at state and federal levels. Number one is gain value for hydropower by educating House and Senate leadership. I think we were largely successful there, and that was in the first quarter, but certainly towards the latter part of the quarter, then the focus shifted to COVID-19, which is why it's yellow. And under two, agree on 2021 legislative priorities with internal stakeholders. Certainly COVID-19 is we are reprioritizing state and federal focus and emphasis. And so we do suspect that some of our priorities may shift somewhat. So more to come on that as we provide future updates.
Commissioners, item P is regard to NESC compliance through the third-party pole attachment agreements. We had planned to have those agreements completed the end of the first quarter. However, we had a change in staff. Katie Marshall was leading that effort, and she has taken a new position. So we anticipate with hiring and backfilling may take a while, so we're anticipating a six-month extension.
And then this is Justin, under Q1, work with City of Wenatchee to develop stormwater outfall master plan for the Horan area. Continue to have good discussions with the city, although they have had some staffing changes of late. And so we do anticipate that this time frame will slip from June 1st at least into the third quarter. All right, commissioners, this is Justin again. I have the entirety of page 6, which is dedicated to various facilities, plans, and projects. And it's fair to say that facilities projects are, there's just a lot of uncertainty overall regarding cost and schedule. So I'll walk through each of these briefly. Number one is Rock Island facilities. At present, construction is estimated to be up to 3 months delayed due to COVID-19 impacts. Under two, Rocky Reach and CM facilities, we are seeing impacts there as well. and that's impacting our strategies relative to bidding and when we how we bid that work. And so we're anticipating that there's some consolidation of the bidding schedule and a resulting 3 to 4 month delay. And B is a similar impact. So I'll skip down to C, which is complete the district service center and fully move in accordance with our goals. So you're going to see all those next three items as yellow because of COVID-19 impacts. So under A, site development, notice to proceed with guaranteed maximum price. I believe right now we're looking at approximately an 8 week delay. And then under B, construction, notice to proceed with a guaranteed maximum price for the balance of projects. We had anticipated, you'll see there, a December 2020 date to have the MAC and notice to proceed processed. And looking probably at quarter one of 2021 at present. And then C, define aesthetics for service center. COVID-19 impacts here are unknown, but we continue to work on aesthetics with internal and community groups. And we are planning a board presentation in May, so we'll have more information for you at that time. Now at the bottom of the page, facilitate the productive reuse of the Fifth Street campus. So the redevelopment plan is complete, and we have a presentation for you here shortly, later on this morning.
This is Kirk at the top of page 7. We've got T2, that's to develop a community coalition to identify overarching approach for the Plain-Lake-Wenatchee transmission hardening system project. And we actually had to delay that one due to COVID-19 just because we had meetings scheduled in March with people in the community that had to be canceled.
This is John. I have the next section under you. This is all around the fire risk management strategy. We have a number of goals underneath there. The first one was to hire an additional forester resource. That's yellow due to the fact that although in recruiting, it's just a slower process given the circumstances. The next one is to gear up with the budget in 2020 to do more vegetation management. We pretty much rely on contracted crews, and with the shelter in place, we lost some of those resources. So that's red. The next one is make a recommendation for an automation, how we manage the veg program, generally through technology. That's yellow as well, again, just due to the slowdown from COVID-19. I'm going to jump down to the next section, which is W, and that's all around substation planning, siting, and construction. We have the first one, number one, deploy two new mobile substations. Those are being procured, although we are seeing a slowdown from the QAQC firm we have planned, so that's yellow. The next one is on the bid construction work for OMI substation that we have by year end. It is yellow as well, just again due to some of the delays and slowdown in the procurement efforts. Bidders have asked for extensions, things of that nature. And then the third one is under the energizing the Holly Street substation. That is, we're targeting that as red, again, due to some slowdowns in procurement, and in this case, a control building that is past the due date.
Next item, this is Kirk. At the top of page 8 is executing 80% of our capital plans on generation and transmission. We're just under the 80% at 74%. The biggest driver there is just some forecasted timing of Powerhouse 2 spending.
John, I have a second one for customer utilities. As mentioned earlier with the substation as well as some of the other larger capital projects, we are under the target currently at 65.7.
This is Mike. Item 3. Capital projects for fiber, they're off to a slow start with the exception of the customer installations, and that's because the crews are executing on that even during the COVID period.
This is Justin. I've got the next one. You'll see that we're just under 40%, and the primary driver there is limited spending at facilities, the facility projects. Okay, I've got the next three as well. Under A, successfully meet hydro license requirements. A2, contracts in place to meet hatchery production targets. That has been completed. We had a target of February 1st, and that was not completed until March. Under 3, evaluate alternatives to WDFW hatchery operations monitoring and evaluation. That evaluation process is going well. We've seen a little bit of inefficiencies just due to reprioritization as a result of COVID-19. So we're still shooting for that 6:30 deadline. That may slip 30 days or so. And then 4, funding of the tributary component of NNI, that was completed and is and completed on time by 1/31 this year.
This is Kirk again. We had a couple goals oil related at the hydros. First one was oil accountability plan to complete it by March 19th, and it was completed on that date. Next one was a feasibility report for environmentally acceptable lubricants, and that one was due the same date, March 19th. We actually postponed that, received an extension to April 20th, which was met. But it's colored red because it missed the date.
Okay, this is Justin. I'm on page 10. I've got the only one on that page. Under G, execute plan to conduct 10-year HCP project survival studies. Under G1, select contractor and finalize study design. So we're continuing to develop the RFP, and you're actually going to be provided an update this morning with our quarterly Fish and Wildlife update, so I will limit my comments.
I've got the next one. This is the U.S. provided notice to terminate the power provisions of the Columbia River Treaty. It's red. The U.S. has made a proposal to the Canadians. There is no indication that they are including termination as an option at this point.
This is Greg Carrington, and I have the next 4. The first one was to revise the long-term hedging strategy through the Risk Management Committee. That was completed on time. The next 3 are delayed. They're delayed primarily because energy planning and trading, we were down about 5 people in our group. We've been able to replace 1 of the 5 people. One position is currently posted, and we don't know what the status of getting people to respond to that. And then another position has just been approved today. So the first one had to do with developing a long-term power sales plan. That has been slowed down. The second was taking into account the strategic planning, develop and identify and attract new companies into Chelan County. And the third one was to find an approach to have industrial hub within Chelan County.
Jerry? This is Ann.
Yes, Ann.
Hi, yeah. I wonder, could we go back to Steve's short report on the Columbia River Treaty? I didn't hear, his voice kind of trailed off at the end of it, so I didn't probably hear the most important part of it. So could Steve repeat that, please?
Sure. So it's been reported that the U.S. government has made a proposal to the Canadians that has not been disclosed to us as to the specifics around it. But given that they're pursuing that proposal, there's no indication at this time that they are pursuing a termination notice. And the target is really built around issuing the termination notice.
Any sense of what the proposal is about?
We have probed in a lot of different places and a lot of different ways, and we have very little information to report to you.
Really? Interesting. Okay. Thank you, Steve.
So next up is I've got, and that's to develop joint principles with BPA regarding a new Canadian entitlement allocation agreement. This is connected to what we were just talking about. It's what happens in the post-24 period when our contract expires. We have had conversations with Bonneville. It's gone slower than we would like. We had conversations even last week about it. It's colored yellow, though, because we're not seeing the kind of progress that we would like to see for something that's coming up on us. Even though 2024 seems like a long way away, it doesn't seem that long to us relative to the planning horizon.
And I have the next one, which is develop a plan with Bonneville regarding the Pacific Northwest Coordination Agreement. That is related to the Columbia River Treaty in some ways. It's necessary in order to calculate headwater benefits as an example of that. We anticipate that that will be delayed primarily because our communications with Bonneville and the Columbia River Treaty have been delayed, and we're waiting for them to kind of work through that process. We've been diligently trying to meet with them. The next one on the list is the implementation of what's called Phase 2 of the independent operations. That may be implemented. Portions of it will be implemented through the operating group, but the portions of it related to the power trading side of it are going to be delayed this year.
Now turning to page 13, this is Kelly. About a third of the way down the page on 4N1, related to our debt portfolio optimization activities, we did make the go-no-go decision at the end of Q1. I'm going to provide the foreshadowing that we had a successful optimization activity, but you will hear more this afternoon under manager's items.
John, again, I have the next section. It's under O, and that's on the long-term rate plans, consistent with the strategic plan. We had a goal to approve a 5-year rate schedule for electric, the 3%. That was approved, so that is complete. The next one, we also had an implement a 4% increase for water wastewater. That, too, was approved by the objective, so that's complete. However, on the implement that rate increase, obviously, that was, under the current circumstances, delayed to 12-1, so that is red.
And this is Mike. I have the next two, item 03, A and B. We did seek and get board approval on the fiber 3% annual increase, and that was coded as blue. The implementation, as were all the others, was delayed to 12-1, so that's coded red.
And commissioners, the next one is under 4, low-income rate assistance program review. We have a complete for the provide rate assistance options to the board. Obviously, that's ongoing, but that was completed.
We're now on Objective 5 and Item A for Objective 5, hydroactual operating expenses. Colored that one yellow at 83.4%, simply due to the delays of C10 and C11 long-term repairs, which were reprioritized so we could focus on the C1 through 7 priorities.
I have the next one under C on the water actual operating expenses. We are under the target range of the floor of 90%. We're at 87.9, but anticipate to catch up over the year.
I have item E, the fiber actual operating expenses. We started the quarter a little bit behind due to accruals and have some slow starts on contract spending, mostly for the HVAC replacement at the nodes and the Nokia support contract. That should catch up.
Item J is colored yellow. We had a goal to develop a transmission interconnection process by June 30th, and we've had to reprioritize some of the transmission staff resources working on that for the COVID-19 response.
I have the next one under K. We have one to present to the board some policy options regarding standard proportional share of infrastructure needs, things like system development charges. We are still working through that, but at this point it's coded yellow, just given the uncertainty and the slowdown and looking for a consultant to assist us. Number two, right underneath that, was to establish an economic development liaison position. That's been put on hold, so that's red. We had hoped to have that filled by the end of Q1, but again, we put that on hold for the time being. The next section is L, and that's regarding the customer information system. The first one was to go live with the customer information system. That was complete, so that's blue. Related to that is achieve CIS stability, generally allowing 3 months once you went live to have that complete. That is yellow. I will note that the system is operating. It's operating well, but we've stressed it to some degree with the credit and collection activity and the changing of how that's coded and configured, as well as we've had an increase in meter reading estimates. So we're still watching and monitoring that very closely.
And then this is Kelly with the last item on page 15, which is M3A. And this relates to our cybersecurity programs for the business system. And we did complete our C2, M2 prioritization matrix by the end of Q1, which is just how we ensure that we're working on the priority items for cybersecurity.
Moving to the next page, I have the item with respect to business continuity activity. We were looking to participate in the National GridX process that is a way of testing your business planning process, particularly for cybersecurity. We've had very little ability to spend time on that given all the COVID-19 activities.
Morning, Commissioners. Tim Pettit, Director of Safety and HPI. Moving to Objective 6 on page 17 under A, business unit attendance at safety meetings. That is red at this time. We've experienced a number of challenges through the COVID-19. At this point, we have a few options in place. The numbers are looking better for this month. Number 4, which is recommendations given as a result of a safety event within 45 days. We've moved to a new way of reporting this year, still working through the some changes in tracking in PeopleSoft. We should have those ironed out shortly, but the numbers are looking well. And then under B, 4 days away restricted or transferred, which is our DART rate. That number is red at 1.24. Our goal was 1.05. A couple challenges with that. Of course, our employees getting back to their doctor's appointments with this COVID-19 effect.
And moving to the next page, page 18, this is Lorna Klemanski, Managing Director of Human Resources. I have 3 items there, items D1, D2, and E1, that are all delayed, related to delayed in hiring because of COVID-19. So those are all employee development items, and they're related to a delay in hiring the Learning and Development Program Manager.
Commissioners, Tim Pettit again. Under G, which is our Human Performance Roadmap, that is red at this time. We continue to make progress with some individuals we're partnering with, but the rollout of that here at the district is red.
Good morning, Commissioners. Eric Walquist here. I have some reporting at the top of page 19, all related to the implementation of the governance, risk, and compliance solutions. You see that the first 3 under A1, 2, and 3 all have a June 30 deadline. Those are all challenged by the COVID-19 circumstances. Getting people together to have those conversations has been a challenge. We are trying to make advancements where we're able. We have not yet failed on the June 30 metric and are still hoping to achieve it, but it is yellow because we do believe that that will be difficult. The fourth item has a end of the year a deadline. We have indicated that as yellow as well, even though it's some time out, simply because that plan is going to be somewhat dependent upon the outcomes of the earlier metrics. John, I'll give it to you.
Sorry, I had my mute button on. Commissioners, I have the next one under the technology roadmap section. We have a goal by the end of June to present to you an automated metering infrastructure purchase and implementation contract. We're making good progress. However, we rely on a lot of subject matter experts who have a lot of things going on. So we've coded that yellow at this point in time.
And the final item on page 19 is item B2D. And we have plans to conduct a across the district business process improvement effort around our GIS business processes. While the due date isn't till the end of the year, we have delayed the start of that effort, and so we anticipate that that completion date may be in jeopardy. And this is the district-wide process. There are pockets of the organization that have been able to kind of focus on improvements for their individual areas, and this is the effort to bring it all together from a district-wide perspective. So just a caution on that one, that because of COVID-19, we've been delayed and may not complete by the end of the year.
This is Kirk at the top of page 20. again, under the technology roadmap work, this is advanced distribution management system. This is one of the key pieces to an outage management system, and we have this one colored red simply because the factory acceptance testing will not be completed by the end of the year. It's scheduled for Q1 of 2021, and that's due to contract delays.
And this is Kelly. I have the next four that are all under that same umbrella of our technology roadmap. And starting with 7.4, we have established a roadmap steering committee to ensure that we have a district-wide alignment of all these roadmaps. There are many roadmaps, and we want to ensure that we do stay in the right order and coordinated with all of them, and that's the purpose of the steering committee, and it has been established and is functioning. In the next category, it's around our implementing our Azure Information Protection, which you'll also hear referred to as AIP, and it's one of the things that needs to be in place before we can do secure mobility and other mobile applications. So we have procured the licenses, so you see that marked blue as complete. And then the next step is to implement those protections across the district. While we are progressing well on this, we have a lesson learned from implementation of some of our current items like Skype. And so we want to ensure that the user experience is fully there's a lot of education around it, and it's deployed in a manner that can help with that. So we believe that we're going to need to extend that one beyond the due date to ensure that we have a good user experience for adopting these additional protections and procedures. And then finally, C is deploying the Lake and River Level app, also known as Current, and happy to report that that one is blue as it was completed, and the iPhone version of it was rolled out at the end of Q1 as planned, and then a good update is now the Android version is also available. So happy to report that that one is complete.
And this is Greg Carrington for item 7C, 1 through 4. The first one, which was to develop a plan to address the energy issues in Sahegan, was completed. We did the customer outreach. We were moving forward with the plan that was outlined to you all. We have developed an RFP for battery technology in Sahegan. It's ready to go, but based on feedback from the industry, we are waiting until people are back at work and can get a full response for the bids associated with that. So that is currently on hold, waiting for people to be able to respond to that RFP.
So I will wrap up our presentation just to say that of the 210 items that we're tracking, we're on track for 62%. That is substantially below what we would normally have at this point in the year. But you can also see that roughly a quarter of the activities that we have been tracking are impacted by COVID-19. If we hadn't had that and we had been able to complete them, we'd be more up in the high 80s someplace. Probably more like what we would anticipate being at this time of the year. So there's just no doubt about it. We've said it before. COVID-19 has dealt some pretty significant body blows to the district performance plan. It continues to do so as we try to figure out the path forward for how we will get back to something like a new normal. And that still is in the future. We don't know how long that will take.
Steve?
Uh-huh.
This is Randy. And just a thought, and maybe it's not major, but there are three items on this list that you've listed as red that were forced by commission action. Just stepping back from it, should those still be red, or should we move the target date for implementing rate increases on water, wastewater, and electricity to December, which turned all of those red in your eyes? Should they be red, or should they be otherwise, since we've just moved goalposts on you?
Well, I think that's really a commission choice. The way we look at it is, does the district perform? That, you know, we're all together and this is a team, and that it's not really a distinction so much between our actions and the board's actions. It's how the district overall performs. So for that reason, we've coded it as red, but I think it's ultimately a board choice about how we look at any of these measurements.
Well, personally, this is one commissioner speaking, but I actually think that should remain green unless it's not implemented as we established it at our meeting not too long ago. It should remain green until December. That's one commissioner.
Randy, this is Gary. What I might suggest is that we put an agenda item on the board workshop to really step back and take a closer look at all the impacts of COVID-19. And it strikes me as that the red list that we've just gone through and the significant impact on achieving goal really is a reflection on the overall impact COVID-19 has on the district. So it's kind of a measuring stick that maybe at some point in the future, as we look back, we might have a way of measuring the total overall impact to the district. That's just a thought and a concept, and maybe we just have Rebecca put it on the board workshop as a topic of discussion.
I think that's a good idea, Gary.
Okay. Rebecca, would you please add that to the board workshop?
I will do.
Thank you.
Any other comments from the board?
This is Steve McKenna. I wanted to know if I could ask Greg Harrington a question about the heat train, or Steve.
Yeah, I'm here.
Great. Go ahead, Steve.
Thank you. Could you just give me a reminder or a refresher on the deed grant? Is that something, that grant that we've applied for that battery, is that an automatic approval if you apply for it, or were we accepted for that if we then wanted to make the decision to participate in that and meet the requirements? Can you just give me an update on that, please?
So we applied for it, and we were granted a certain amount of funding associated with the project itself. After you get approved for it, then you have to take a look at the terms and conditions of that, and then you also have to coordinate with the project schedule. We were right in the middle of the review of the deed grant, and we're in the process of doing the RFP that would use the funding for that, and then everything came to a stop, and so I don't know, and I can find this out for you, what the status is of all the deed grants that were issued that are delayed because of the COVID-19 response. So that, I do not know what the status of that is.
Great. I don't think I need to know that. I know you guys will keep track of that. I just needed a refresher on that, so I got out of that what I needed. Thank you very much.
Okay, thanks.
Okay. If there's nothing else, we'll move on to our next agenda item, which is the fisheries program update. I'll be turning this over to Aline Underwood.
Hi. Good morning, commissioners. This is Aline Underwood, Fish and Wildlife Manager here at the PUD. And I just want to say thanks for the opportunity to come and visit with you again about some of the programs that we are involved in. Today we've got two to discuss with you. The first is an update on our Skaha and Okanagan Lake sockeye reintroduction. Catherine Willard will be giving that update. And I was looking back in my files, and we haven't actually talked to you about this program since about 2013, when the commission last approved the final budget modification for the hatchery that we built. So a lot has happened in the past 7 years, and we're really excited about where that program has taken us. So, again, Catherine will talk about that. And then secondly, we want to talk about our project confirmation studies under our habitat conservation plans for both Rocky Reach and Rock Island. This is intended to be a bit of an educational presentation about why we do project confirmation studies and also a look forward to what we may do this year or in 2021 or 2022. So with that, I will hand it over to Catherine to talk to you about the sockeye program.
All right. Good morning, and I will begin on slide 3 in your package. I'm here today to provide an update on the Skaha and Okanagan Lake Sockeye Reintroduction Program, which is located just across the border in Canada. The expectations of this program have been exceeded, and the district's involvement has been integral in the success of the program. The implementation of the program is a collaborative effort between the Okanagan Nation Alliance, the district, the Canadian provincial government, and the Canadian Department of Ocean Fisheries. The Okanagan Nation Alliance leads the effort. The program began in 2003 as a 12-year experimental sockeye reintroduction program. The district conducted an extensive alternative analysis to determine the best option for successful sockeye reintroduction beginning in 2009. And determined that construction of the new hatchery was the best option for success. In 2010, the HCP Hatchery Committee signed an SOA that established that the district received no net impact credit from natural and hatchery origin smolts produced from Skaha and Okanagan Lakes. The smolt target is 591,040 smolts. And it's important to note that these are natural and hatchery produced smolts, which is different from our other programs where we get credit for hatchery-produced smolts. The Board of Commission approved funding for construction of the hatchery in 2011, and then cost for the hatchery construction was shared with Grant PUD. Grant's proportion is 66%, and Chelan's proportion is 34%. Go ahead and turn to slide 4. At the top of the slide is the native name for the hatchery. I won't try to pronounce it. We just refer to it as the Penticton Hatchery. The hatchery construction was completed in 2013, and the first fry were released in 2014. The hatchery was constructed for a 5 million egg take. Initially, the district funded the construction of the hatchery for approximately $4.5 million. Again, this was split with Grant PUD. And then now annually, the district funds hatchery ops staff, a laboratory which provides services to include disease testing for fish, aging of the sockeye, and different limnological analyses, and a monitoring evaluation program to assess the effectiveness of the hatchery program and its contribution of the hatchery program to the natural population.
Question.
Again, we share these costs with Grant PUD for the same split of 66% for Grant and 34% for Chelan.
Go ahead. Randy, go ahead. Did you have a question?
Yeah, I did. I was just curious. You raised a question in my mind, and I didn't see it in the presentation. In terms of the oversight of this project, and with recognizing we're splitting the cost, is Chelan in charge of the oversight, or Grant, or how does that work?
Yeah, that's a really good question. And so we share oversight, even though Grant has a bigger monetary contribution, we split the oversight 50-50, essentially. And so that oversight includes we both review budgets and projects, and then we have monthly meetings with the ONA, Hatchery staff, and M&E staff to provide oversight for the program.
Okay, thank you.
You're welcome.
Gary, may I jump in here now as long as we have our sister?
Yes, Ann, go ahead.
Okay. Catherine, you'll probably not be surprised at my question because we've talked about this before but haven't had a chance to meet. So you talk about the hatchery-raised and natural-raised smolt. So I am just curious. I'm curious about the natural-raised smolt, and are these going to be truly wild, wild sockeye salmon? How does that work, I guess, in short?
Oh, yeah, no, that's a good question, too. I use common terminology because it's my life. But so the hatchery-produced smolts come from adults that we bring into the hatchery, and we spawn them in the hatchery, and they're reared in the smolts are reared in the hatchery and then released. In this case, we release them as fry, which is a younger-aged fish. And the natural origin smolts that we're referring to here they're produced from adults that return and spawn in the Okanagan River, and then any of their progeny are considered natural origin smolts. And so the district, for our NNI component, we get credit for both the natural produced smolts and the hatchery produced smolts that we produce in our hatchery.
Okay, so the natural produced smolts they come from two wild adults, and so it's going to be their DNA is going to be, a natural, naturally reproduced wild smolt, correct?
Well, actually, though, we call them natural produced, not wild, because the natural produced smolts could actually be from hatchery produced adults that spawn in the wild. Does that make sense? So there could be hatchery adults that return and spawn, and then they produce smolts that were never in the hatchery, but their parents came from the hatchery.
Okay, so really, it's just kind of semantics, Catherine. I mean, they're still a naturally produced. Their DNA still goes through the whole recombination process like a wild salmon does. I guess, or maybe we should talk offline because I'm just curious about, are we preserving our wild population of fish?
Yeah, and that is a great question and a big topic of discussion in the hatchery world. And we should talk offline on that. But I will say that we've learned a lot about hatchery fish and that we do a lot to minimize the negative effects that hatcheries can have on fish. And so we should definitely have a conversation offline.
Okay, one last question really quickly. So do we have a certain quota of, I think I heard you say that, of naturally produced smolts that we have to meet, a percentage of hatchery and a percentage of natural?
No, it's just a combined number of smolts, and it can be...
Okay.
Any combination of natural or hatchery produced smolt.
Okay. All right. Thank you, Catherine.
Sure. Okay, let's turn to slide 5. The hatchery is located on Shingle Creek, which is on the map between Okanagan Lake and Skaha Lake. Broodstock are collected in the Okanagan River by the Okanagan Nation Alliance in October and November, and hatchery spawning occurs in October and November as well. This hatchery, we release fry in the spring versus most of our hatcheries here in the Wenatchee, we release them as smolts, so we hold them over another year. So these fish, again, are spawned in the fall, and then we release them in the spring. The majority of the fry are released directly from the hatchery into Shingle Creek, and they move down into Skaha Lake to rear. The sockeye smolts outmigrate from the lake the following spring and go to the ocean. And then the adults return to spawn in the Okanagan River after spending 2 to 3 years in the ocean. Historically, Okanagan sockeye salmon migration was blocked by the construction of McIntyre Dam, which is on the outlet of Vasu Lake, and Skaha Dam, which is on the outlet of Skaha Lake. And this blockage occurred in the 1950s, thus the need for a reintroduction of sockeye. McIntyre Dam was altered to provide fish passage in 2009, and Skaha Outlet Dam was altered to provide fish passage in 2014. Okanagan Lake Outlet Dam, which is on the outlet of Okanagan Lake, is the current migration barrier, which I will discuss more in a couple of slides. So we can turn to slide 6. And I'll provide an overview of our releases. So the first hatchery fry release from the Penticton hatchery was brood year 2014, which is release year 2015. Into Skaha Lake. Prior to brood year 2014, you'll see there were several releases. These fish were reared at the Shuswap hatchery in Canada. Brood year 2016 was the first ceremonial release of about 10,000 fry into Okanagan Lake. Ceremonial release was for the Okanagan Nation Alliance elders. And then in brood year 2018, release year 2019, all 4.1 million fry went to Okanagan Lake. There weren't any fry that went to Skaha Lake because Skaha was at carrying capacity and the Okanagan Nation Alliance was moving toward establishing sockeye into Okanagan Lake. The majority of the adults from this 2019 release into Okanagan Lake will begin to return in 2022. And if you recall, I mentioned there is currently not adult passage into Okanagan Lake. Which brings us to the next slide, slide 7. So historically, the Canadian provincial government was not supportive of the reintroduction of sockeye into Okanagan Lake for various reasons. However, within the past 2 years, the provincial government changed their position to fully support the reintroduction of sockeye into Okanagan Lake. And together with the Okanagan Nation Alliance, and the provincial government, they've been working together to modify the existing fishway into Okanagan Lake to allow passage. And this passage is will be established by 2022 when adults from that release in 2019 will start to return. So this is super important, and what does it mean for the district? So we are currently meeting our NMI target of hatchery and natural origin smolt being produced. The Skaha Lake Sockeye Reintroduction Program was an interim step to eventual reintroduction into Okanagan Lake. That is the gem of this program. So we used the lessons learned from Skaha and applied them to Okanagan Lake. And to date, there hasn't been no outstanding issues with reintroducing sockeye into Skaha Lake. The production capacity of sockeye smolts from Okanagan Lake is 10 times what Skaha Lake is based on, or it's 10 times what Skaha Lake is just based on the size of the lake. By expanding the reintroduction effort into Okanagan Lake, it further ensures the district will continue to meet its NNI credit and puts us in a favorable position for negotiating our next HCP Hatchery Committee SOA that expires in 2021. The success of the Skaha and Okanagan Lake sockeye reintroduction program would not have been possible without the district's funding and, as we talked about, our technical oversight that the district's fishery staff provides. Are there any questions?
I have a question. This is Gary Arsenault. And in terms of looking at the map, can you describe to me the various locations where there are hydro projects that block passage of those fish into the U.S.?
So there aren't, the only passage blockage currently is on Okanagan Lake. So the McIntyre Dam has fish passage.
Okay.
And Skaha Lake Outlet Dam has fish passage. And so then if you go north, the only one that doesn't currently have passage is Okanagan Lake Outlet Dam. And that's the, there currently is a fishway there, but it hasn't been activated for 50 years. And so they are working to modify the fishway to allow fish passage when we have all the adults return.
And so then if you go south on the U.S. side, are there any obstacles for those fish on the U.S. side?
Oh, no. Nope. So just south of the border, the next dam is Wells Dam, and then obviously downstream from there. And they all provide passage.
So they do. Okay, great. Thank you very much.
Yeah.
So if there aren't any other questions, I think we'll go on to the next portion of our presentation with Lance.
Yeah, thanks, Elaine. Good morning, commissioners. So I will start my presentation on slide 8. Just want to refresh you quickly. This topic hasn't been brought to the board for quite some time because of the success we've had with measuring juvenile and adult salmon and steelhead survival at Rock Ridge Rock Island Dam. But real quickly, the HCPs for Rock Ridge Rock Island outline that the district must measure survival of the project for Rock Ridge Rock Island. When we say project, it's a little different than down in the lower river at the Army Corps projects. Project survival for Rock Ridge Rock Island Dam includes the reservoir, the dam itself, and 1,000 feet of the tail arrays. So I just want you to keep that in mind as we talk about this going forward. The planned species under the HCP are yearling Chinook, steelhead, sockeye, and coho. Those species of fish outmigrate in the springtime, and then we have the subyearling or summer Chinook that outmigrates later on in the year. We have been able to measure and achieve what we call the gold standard for survival of those spring planned species at Rock Reach and Rock Island Dam. We measured survival at Rock Reach from 2004 to 2011, and then Rock Island from 2003 to 2006 under 20% spill, and then once again in 2007 to 2010 under 10% spill. And when we say the gold standard, we're referring to the 91% combined adult and juvenile survival that is called out in the HCP. So we measure the juvenile component of a particular species. We measure the adult component of a particular species. Through our projects, we multiply them together and then measure them against the 91% survival standard that's outlined in the HCP. So as you can see there, as of 2011, we met the 91% standard for all spring species at both projects. Based on that, the HCP outlines that there are no additional studies needed for 10 years, at which time, though, you do need to perform a confirmation study to illustrate that the phase designation is proper for the project at the same time. One thing of note is if you look at this, we were scheduled to conduct a confirmation study at Rock Island Dam in 2020, but we engaged the coordinating committee and had the confirmation study for Rock Island move to 2021 to allow for the B1B4 work to continue and actually have one of those units available to evaluate survival under. Okay, moving to slide 9. You can see here, these are the survival standards for both the juvenile and adult survival we have achieved at both Rock Reach and Rock Island Dam. The important survival metrics are the combined on the far right column in bold. You can see they're measured against the 91% that's outlined in the HCP, where we are exceeding that survival standard. I mentioned previously coho being a planned species. We have not conducted survival testing for coho, but rather we utilize a surrogacy analysis that showed that their survival is very, very close to yearling Chinook through both Rock Reach and Rock Island. So we were able to present that to the coordinating committees and get phase 3 standard achieved designated for them based on that surrogacy analysis with yearling Chinook. So moving to slide 10, now we're going to kind of transition into the future confirmation studies that we're going to carry out at Rock Reach and Rock Island Dam. The HCP coordinating committee gets to select one representative species to be studied at Rock Reach and one representative species to be studied at Rock Island for all the species that are in that phase three standards achieved at the respective project. And I'm happy to report that the coordinating committee selected yearling Chinook at both Rock Reach and Rock Island Dam at a March meeting. So that's great for the district. So that means we will be evaluating juvenile yearling Chinook migration through the Rock Reach and Rock Island project as they go out to the ocean. And then that same year, we will be monitoring returning adult spring Chinook as they migrate upstream to their spawning grounds through Rock Reach and Rock Island. On the juvenile side of things, we will use acoustic tag technology. So that is the active tag that requires a surgical insertion into the fish, but allows us to determine routes of passage at fish and time, routes of passage of the projects, excuse me, as well as time of passage. And then for the return adults, we'll rely on adults that have been previously pit tagged throughout their lifespan. The HCP outlines that this confirmation study is a one-year evaluation of the combined adult and juvenile survival standard of 91%. So essentially, we will conduct the study of juvenile adult survival, combine them together, and measure them against the 91 percentile. If the results are equal to or greater than 91%, we will have no further spring study obligation until 2031. If the results do fall short of the 91%, the HCP does have language in there that does require additional testing of two more additional years prior to a phase designation change, which would put us back into confirming the survival of that specific species at either Rock Reach or Rock Island. So we've got a few years to test and measure against the 91%. I'm going to move to slide 11 now. So slide 11 has our tentative schedule for conducting the confirmation survival study. And I'll first like to note on this slide that we are in weekly discussion with both Rock Reach and Rock Island hydro projects. As you heard during the district performance plan status update prior to our presentation, we are seeing a lot of movement in schedules of maintenance of units and other projects at the hydro facilities. So fisheries is staying well in contact with those hydro folks and kind of assessing what conditions might be available for us to test at Rock Reach and Rock Island Dam in 2021. Currently, we have an internal go, no-go of trying to implement a survival study in 2021 of June 2020. This is an internal date. If we do at this point do decide that, you know, at one project or another, it doesn't look like a survival study would be representative of future operations and shouldn't be conducted in 2021, we would then have to engage the HCP coordinating committee and get their approval for moving that confirmation study out to an additional year. But nonetheless, this schedule going forward can be viewed as an adaptive process, and we can implement it for this year for a 2021 study or in 2021 for a 2022 study. Justin noted this morning as well that we are currently wrapping up a request for proposal. If the schedule were to hold true, we would advertise that in June and hopefully select a contractor in August. We're bringing that contractor on earlier ahead of the survival study so we can start to gain some efficiencies and maybe some early gear deployment, as well as design how we're going to conduct our study and where we need to release fish and sample sizes and things of that nature to ensure that we have that statistical robustness on the backside once we get the results. We would conduct this confirmation survival study during the spring out migration for juvenile fish, which is mid-April to mid-June, with preliminary results for the juvenile component being available in July and the adult component falling shortly after that. The estimated cost of a two-project survival study for the district is roughly $3.25 million. So it is a bit of an expensive investigation, but so we want to make sure that we're testing under conditions that are representative under the HCP. And at that point, or at this point in the presentation, I would entertain any questions or comments.
Yeah, Lance, this is Dennis. Can we go back to slide 9, please?
Yes.
Okay. This may be the dumbest question that you'd receive from anyone, but let's just go to the bottom of that chart, Rocky Reach, Rock Island 93.59 juvenile, and adult at 98.92, and then the survival is 92%. So tell me about the math.
Yeah, so it's actually, given all the statistical analysis that goes into these studies, it's a very straightforward process. So the 93.59 juvenile percentage that's represented there is representative of multiple years of studies at Rocky Reach for juvenile sockeye. The adult survival number of 98.92% is representative of 3 years of adult survival at Rocky Reach. We essentially, at this point, take these two numbers and average them together, and then measure against the 91%.
So then measure them against the 91%.
Yep, so we average them together. We come up with 92.58%, and then we compare that to the 91%. We're over or achieving a survival above the 91% gold standard in the HCP, so therefore the coordinating committee then moves that species into phase 3 standards achieved.
So, Lance, let me take a shot at this because I think that that your terms could be misinterpreted. So, the average of those two is not taking the 98.9 and 93.5 and finding the midpoint between them, the median, the mean, whatever. It actually is a cumulative effect. So, a sockeye has a mortality rate that it incurs at Rock Island, and then a mortality rate that it occurs at Rocky Reach, and I think that's what's happening here. Is that right?
No, so I get what you're saying, Stephen. My apologies. Yeah, so we essentially multiply them, those two numbers together, to get that combined adult and juvenile survival. But these calculations for the specific projects are specifically for Rocky Reach or specifically for Rock Island. So there's no cumulative effects, but combined with Rock Reach and Rock Island combined.
Okay, so I took one step too many there. So so it is a combined effect. The average, actually, you multiply them together as opposed to adding them together and dividing by two.
Yes, I believe. My apologies. I don't have a calculator directly in front of me. But yes, essentially, we would multiply those two numbers together to get that measurement against the 91.
Yeah. Does that help, Dennis?
Okay. Yeah, because I was using the traditional math of together and divided by two, and I'm thinking, I'm not the math guy, but that doesn't work. So multiply them together. Thank you.
Yeah, my apologies, Dennis, for the confusion there.
No need to apologize. I just need to understand the process. Thank you.
If there are no other questions, I would just note that, again, the key part about this is we've got a pretty big go-no-go decision coming up in the next 30 to 60 days, and so we'll be reporting back to the board on that. With that, I'm going to say thanks to our fisheries team, and we're going to move on to Dan Frazier and David Lodge to talk about the Fifth Street Redevelopment Plan. They are entering the room as we speak, and we're going to figure out how to put them in a place where they're 6 feet apart. There we go. All right, welcome, guys. You're up.
Thank you. Good morning, Commissioners. Dan Frazier, Director of Shared Services.
David Lodge, Project Manager.
Today we're here to give you an update on the Fifth Street redevelopment planning process, give you a status. There's no board action required today. It's simply informational. So to take us back, just a short recap of what's been done to date. The planning process started last year. A partnership was formed between the PUD, the city, and the port, and engaged our other partners, the Wenatchee Downtown Association and the Chamber of Commerce, and we all five have been working together on this for over a year now. We started out with the community open house. We engaged our advisory groups in working through a visioning workshop and some follow-up workshops, and we conducted a market analysis of some of the ideas, and what came out of that was really three opportunities for the site. We call them area of opportunities or different scenarios for the site. And those are identified in the appendix, but really what they are is a nonprofit-focused redevelopment of the site, a commercial-focused redevelopment of the site and a residential-focused. And what this showed us was that there's market for all of those things, probably not market for just one of those things on the site. And so David will talk a little bit more about what that means in a mixed use. But what we know that at this point is we don't have to decide that now. We'll let some of that work being done help inform the market, and then the market will react to our plans as we go forward. But one of the big things that the planning process identified were barriers about the site. And early on when we started talking about this project is one of the things we talked about was removal of barriers to enable the site to be redeveloped. And so we know there's some work for us to do over the next 6 months to a year. And so David will take you through what our next steps are going through this process.
So in order to get the property ready for sale, there's quite a few tasks that we have to do in a master development type plan. So as Dan mentioned, the redevelopment is probably too large for one developer. So as a property owner, we can break it up into smaller pieces and get it ready for market. So we're continuing to work with the city and the port, and we're going to clarify their roles going forward in a revision to the interlocal agreement. And we'll need to develop a plan and timeline for doing some infrastructure improvements and getting the property ready. And then also, we need to develop a plan for marketing the site and potentially even phasing the development that's going to occur. And ultimately, the goal is to sell off the parcels for vertical construction. So Dan mentioned the three different scenarios or areas of opportunity. But regardless of the direction it heads, there are some things that will occur with every plan. And so we've been calling these the core elements. Our core element plan really doesn't require us to choose a specific direction, but it's things that we can start doing to get the property ready. So that includes developing a parcel plan. How will we break this up into smaller chunks, and what's the logical way to do that? Developing a utility plan to serve all those different parcels that could be under different ownership, and then doing property due diligence, such as an environmental assessment. We'll also need to develop a circulation and parking strategy. So what does parking look like on the site for the various uses? And develop a plan for infrastructure improvements and come up with funding strategies of how we're going to bring those about. We'll also want to develop some design standards because we'll want the development to occur on this site to complement downtown. So we might have some specific guidelines for that. And one idea that came out of our analysis was this idea of a zero carbon district. And maybe that's a way of setting this property apart from other areas for opportunity. So we're going to look at the feasibility of study of that and see if that's could be a reality. So those are some of the core elements. Then we'll want to create a vision for this. We know the different areas of opportunity, but the reality is the ultimate mixed use will take pieces of all of that. We want to create a vision and a sense of place around this and something that unifies the different development concepts and also reflects the community's values. Through that process, we may even identify some potential anchor tenants. But there's a graphic on this slide for creating vision that's a rendering of what could be on this site. And it gives you an idea of the scale of what could be built on the site. What will actually happen may look nothing like that, but it's to give you an idea what it could be. So then how do we actually move this forward? We'll create a marketing plan and develop a strategy for marketing this to different developers that are out there. We'll also create a request for proposal with qualitative selection criteria. And this is where we'll work closely with the port and the city on coming up with this criteria. And again, it's in an effort to reflect the community values. So when we receive multiple proposals, we'll have a way to evaluate them against each other. And then we'll need to do our proper diligence in evaluating different proposals. We'll want to select proposals that have legs and are based in reality, but also meet the community goals. And all the while looking for different financing and tax incentives to help move this along.
So as David outlined, we have a lot of things to do, but one of the things we're cautioning right now is some patience in the current environment. So obviously we have some time until we're moving out, and we've always known that we were looking at a late 22, early 23 move out of the site. But the current economic outlook has, while not, you know, really taking anything off the table, we don't want to push forward with something that that may not be the right mix in the valley here, you know, in the next year or two. So we want to have some patience in seeing what the response to COVID-19 will be in terms of what it means for development in the valley. So a little patience there. We want to allow time for the economy to recover. But we can also continue to look at what things come out of the interest as we move through this process. And the project has a little bit more exposure. We'll start to hear things. I know the port, working through their project, has heard a lot about the redevelopment of the Lineage property. And so we expect to see some of that. And then we can revisit the feasibility work that was done as part of this project. And we want to stay engaged. As David mentioned, the port and the city are definitely engaged in this project. We want to keep them engaged. Obviously, this isn't our core competency. Redeveloping projects is not. But we're the property owner. And unless you have somebody that's really coming in that wants to take the whole site, which at this point we don't have anybody, it's good for us to stay engaged at this level. But keeping our economic development partners involved, the city and the port, and they can help steer us in the right direction as we move through this process. So slide 8 is really our communication plan, and it's what we're planning on doing with our partners over the next several months. We just actually had a meeting on Friday, a telephone meeting with the port, the city, the chamber, and the downtown, Wenatchee Downtown Association. And everybody's actually very optimistic. And so we want to keep moving on this because they think that some of the information that came out of the report, the focus on some residential need is very strong. The city indicates that they're still getting applications for housing projects. So we want to keep our communication with them up and strong. And so we will we'll be amending our interlocal with them to outline the next several months' worth of work. We'll also follow up with our advisory group. Let them know where we're headed and take any feedback. We need to follow up with the Music Theater of Wenatchee. We've been talking with them, but obviously we haven't been meeting too much with them in the last little bit, so we want to make sure that they know they're still part of this process. And then one of the things we wanted to do and one of the reasons we wanted to be here today was that we want to publish the redevelopment report. We want to get it out there in the public and let people look at it. And so we have a copy of that for each of the commissioners, and we'll send out a PDF, but we actually printed out a copy because some of us like tactile, have paper in our hands, so we'll get those to you. And we'd love to hear any feedback, any questions you have. And then we want to go to the public at some point here. We're not sure exactly when that will be, but really to talk about what the report yielded and what the next steps are going forward with the community. So at that point, open for any questions and happy to answer anything you've got.
Commissioners, any questions? Dan, this is Gary. Early on, we had some indications of interest from some local businesses that were thinking of either relocating or maybe expanding in place. Do you know if that interest is still alive?
Yes, the local nonprofit, there is some interest, and they're actually going through their own planning process right now, and I think this parcel is part of that planning process. So I think that's really something that has some legs locally. So we'll continue our discussions with them as they move forward.
Great. Thank you.
Okay, if there are no other questions, Dan, David, you had asked for some feedback from the board before possibly going public. Are you looking for more than what you heard here today? Or?
Not really. I think the idea would be to get the report out. It's great information. Obviously, in the light of what we're in now, it's a little bit dated, but I think it's really good for the public to see what the vision was on the site and get any feedback from the public.
Okay. So, commissioners, it would be our intent then to move forward with releasing the report. You can see there's some pretty good information here and a vision for people to be able to test and see how they feel about particularly the three different options that are out there. Unless there's an objection, we'll be taking that next step forward. Okay, hearing none, you guys are authorized to move forward. Go forth and do good.
All right. Thank you very much.
Okay, this next item is an update on COVID-19 activities and impacts in the community in particular. I'm a little concerned about time, and I want to make sure that we have adequate time for a discussion of assistance for individuals and small businesses. So I'm going to not present the first part of this, what we're doing with the healthcare community, because I think that's something that I was going to do, and I can easily do it this afternoon as part of a manager's item. So I would like to move to the discussion that is set up that Andrew Grissel will be leading. I want to just say it might seem a bit unusual to you to have Andrew lead this. He did put together the low-income assessment discussion at the last meeting. He did such a good job of pulling the group together. We said, keep going. We want to keep you working on this because you've been able to pull a lot of data, a lot of people together. But there are a whole bunch of folks across the district who are contributing to this. I particularly want to call out the Wendells, Carrie and Andy, as well as Sean Seaman, Charles Von Reese, helping us to put this together. Andrew, are you ready to go?
I'm ready to go. So thank you, Steve, and echo those comments from Steve on the rest of the team. Big team effort, lots of information. Appreciate everyone willing just to jump in there. So my name is Andrew Grissel. Manage our energy development conservation team. So good morning, and this is a presentation on the outcomes of additional work looking into potential assistance for individuals and small businesses. It's the add-on to the presentation that we presented a couple weeks ago. So moving to slide 2. The goal for today's presentation is review some updated data, discuss a range of options to support businesses and individual customers impacted by the state shutdown. I will include some cost estimates on those options. And most importantly, we're going to seek guidance from the board on the direction the staff should take moving forward. Slide 3, I wanted to provide an update on the unemployment trends in Chelan County. There were almost 2,000 new claims over the last 2 weeks to bring the total up to just over 7,000 unemployment claims. As we look through which sectors of the economy that were impacted, we see that construction is still represented in large numbers. This includes heavy civil engineering construction, the regular residential construction, and then also the specialty trades construction, those groups that support the other entities. Hospitality and services are still represented in relatively large numbers as well. And then merchant wholesalers of non-durable goods. And I had to go and look up what this was because I didn't know. And so it's distributors to restaurants, clothing distributors, all those sorts of things fall under that category. And so obviously those businesses have been hit hard. So the supporting businesses are being hit as well. And then there's a large portion that called non-disclosed, and there were over 600 of those in the last 2 weeks. We just don't know where they came from. They're unemployed during this time period, but as far as what the industry they're in, we're not sure.
Andrew, I'd like to add one thing to this. Some of the national economists are saying that while we've seen a decline in the last few weeks, that there's an expectation that these numbers are going to increase in the next few weeks because the eligibility for the federal program was only released about 2 weeks ago. So they're more people are realizing that they're going to be eligible for the program, and consequently there's an expectation these numbers are going to jump.
We'll keep track of that, and we'll keep following those two and keep inputting that data into the tracking. So thank you. Slide 4, here's some customer call stats. This slide provides an update on information from our stakeholder relations team. On the left side in the middle, we see changes between April 6th and April 20th on contacts and active payment arrangements. Customers contacting the PD with hardships have increased among all of the groups. For the electrical, a total of 200. Those are broken up into the residential and commercial. We see that it went from 110 in April 6th to 166 as of April 20th. And then on the commercial side, there were 20 that were called in, and then as of April 6th was 20, and as of April 20th there was 34. And then customers with payment with active payment arrangements has actually dropped over the last couple weeks. As of April 6th, we had 65, and as of April 20th, there were 29. And currently, there are no long-term arrangements that are out more than a month. And then if we move over to the revenues past due, we see that there was an increase from April 6th to April 20th in the residential side. But on the commercial side, there was a decrease. And so on the commercial side, some small businesses have caught themselves back up. I wanted to just pause here for a minute to see if any questions. Carrie's also on the line, and so if there are any specific questions with regards to what the team is seeing, she's more than happy to provide some additional narrative around that. Okay. I'll move forward to slide 5. This is just a review of our current and potential future actions. We've changed the slide slightly to better represent what the district is doing and what the district could do. And so you'll see there's two levels. We have potential options that we will discuss later, falls under this level 2 area. And we'll cover those in more detail later in the presentation. We have specifically something called direct bill credits discounts that fall under level 2. And there's, again, we'll be discussing that in greater detail later on. But we do have our payment arrangements, our no disconnect, late fees until the end of July. We have federally funded energy assistance programs, our customer funded Helping Hands program, and then when the board just recently deferred the rate increase. And so those are all actions that we have already taken. So now we'll move into sort of the here to talk about. And so at the last board meeting, we heard the board. We asked the board, how should we help, and should we help? And we heard yes, but there are some sideboards, and programs need to help those who are impacted and the most in need. Programs should be light on administration. We heard the concern from the board about staff resources and staff time, and we also wanted to see some order of magnitude costs. What could these cost? And while also taking into account the state and federal dollars that are being directed toward the crisis. And so we think that's what we heard. I just want to stop here and provide a moment to see if that was right.
Commissioners, any guidance to Andrew?
This is Randy. I think they heard us quite clearly. I'm looking at what they've got laid out. I do have a question that maybe is not answerable today. Andrew, back on page 4, the numbers have revenue past due. The numbers have jumped appreciably. Is that a fair statement?
That is a fair statement for residential. Yes.
Well, percentage, yeah, I guess on a percentage basis and a real basis, yes, yeah. I'm curious if you've been able to gather or capture the sense of the people that are late. Has there been any conversation or not?
Sherry, do you have some additional information on conversations with those customers?
I'm sorry, can you repeat that question?
Well, I'm wondering if, you know, our numbers of late payers residential have skyrocketed since we had the last report, actually. And I'm wondering if there's been any conversations with those customers. Is there a sense of those conversations?
Yeah, Randy, we have had a lot of conversations with the customers. We've made a lot of extra calls lately, but I think because we're not following our normal credit and collection process, which includes the disconnections and the door hangers and serviceman visits, since we're not following through with those processes, we have a lot of our customers that normally are past due know how our processes work. And so I think that's a big majority of that past due balance.
Thank you.
So this is Gary, and you just said something that kind of struck a chord. Is there a look at how much of this money or how much of this delinquency are habitual late folks compared to how much of it is new?
I believe that that amount is the majority of that is normal. But, you know, most of the people that are contacting us that are not working right now because of COVID are calling us in way advance of being past due, which that revenue past due is over 61 days. And the majority of the people that are contacting us with the hardship are new customers that are in that 1 to 45 days past due compared to the habitual past due customers. Does that make sense?
It does, and I led to another question, and that is that regarding some of the issues surrounding the board and perhaps some of the decisions we'll be facing, it would be very helpful if we had a measurement that kind of cut the wheat from the chaff as to who lives like this every month that we deal with versus who is actually someone impacted by a job loss caused by COVID-19. Is there any way that you can think of to help us to be able to dissect the numbers and come up with that kind of an answer?
Well, I can work on that. We are tracking if they've had multiple past due notices or if they're one time. So I have some tracking on some of that, Gary, that I can put together. We also have about 200 of them right now that we're monitoring. So I can look at those 200 and tell you from there how many of them are one time and how many of them have multiple.
But you know, that would be really helpful in terms of working, at least for one commissioner here, to come up with something reasonable that is going to help those impacted by COVID versus those that have a lifestyle that makes them delinquent on their bill all the time. I mean, those are two different class of folks that, you know, they don't deserve to be treated the same way, if you know what I'm getting at. And so it would be very helpful to be able to, even if it's not a 100% accurate number, if it's a really good, strong estimate number, you know, based on how many times those folks would have found themselves in this position, that would be helpful.
Okay, I can do that. And then just as another side note, you know, this last week with the stimulus checks coming out, we've received a lot of payments. And a lot of these customers, when they called in, they said, well, how much am I past due? And then how much is my full balance? And then they just paid the full balance. So I thought that was a good sign. And last week we had a pretty good positive week of payments. And so, you know, hopefully that keeps up.
Commissioners, before we move on, I was looking for a place to make this point, and so I'd like to just do it here. I realize that I probably should have suggested that we change the question here a little bit on page 6, which says, should we do something for individuals and small businesses, to should we do something more for individuals and small businesses. One of the things that you'll see later are estimates of costs of various options. One of the things that we have not estimated yet is the cost of what we're doing now. So we know that there's some increased carrying cost associated with higher balances that are delinquent. That's probably pretty modest because we don't earn very much on money in reserves today. But I know that there are a number of utilities around the country that are worried about increased delinquencies as a result of larger balances that could be accrued. And in fact, the investor-owned utilities have begun an initiative on Capitol Hill to see if they could get tax credits for the incremental amount of larger delinquencies compared against what they have historically experienced. And so there is a risk there that we have not quantified with respect to our current practice. And I just want to make sure that I put that on the table so that you're aware that that's a cost that we don't have included here. With that, Andrew, I'll turn it back over to you.
Thank you. So we'll move on to slide 7. So this is really talking about, okay, how much could be out there to help provide some relief for our customers. Recently, the Public Power Benefit Program was increased from $4 to $6 million. This increase were allocated to COVID-19. This would make approximately $2 million available. We have committed to other actions in order to support the community during COVID-19, and those are expected to cost around $350,000. These include, programs like the hotspot program, as well as support for community health. So there's sort of a number of what could be available out there, and as we move forward with the cost, we'll see how that matches up against that. The other question is, if we provide bill relief, then when? We have three options, and we discussed three different lines. There's basically now, covering the March, April, May time period. There's through the end of July. This is when our cutoff and late fee policy is scheduled to end. And then we could also lean towards fall. There's a risk for COVID-19 rebound in the fall, and so how do we look at doing that? So the team leans towards the end of July, since it aligns with our timelines for other actions like disconnects and late fees. We may also want to think about leaving some reserve funds in case COVID-19 rebounds in the fall. That could have a negative impact on our local economy. So just as the economy might start getting going again towards the end of summer, we have another sort of a wave of infections that causes some additional hardship from an economic standpoint, I think it's a good idea to leave some reserves for that case. Go to slide 9, talking about which small businesses should be eligible. Identifying impacted businesses is not straightforward. There's a lot of gray area in the list that the state has posted. Additionally, all commercial customers are in the same class, so we can't just take a look at one class and say they are impacted. We can focus there. We believe the options I'll be discussing in the next slide, both in terms of the amount and delivery means, for example, bill credit, will have a large impact on our smaller customers. Focusing on businesses that were forced to close helps those harmed the most. And so as we look at some of the options that we identify later on in the presentation, you'll be seeing that theme running through those options. We'll start looking at those options on page 10. For a commercial customer, of course, we have the status quo, which is maintaining our current programs, waiving late fees and no disconnects through July. Customers can already make payment arrangements and can also be made, including potentially further delays in making payments. Options 2 and 3 are both focused on bill credit for customers in need. The primary difference is how customers are confirmed they're impacted. Option 2 focuses on businesses that are closed down to the COVID-19 shutdown. Customer relations staff would confirm those closures. For option 3 is a wider net, letting customers self-certify in some manner that they have been negatively impacted by COVID-19. In either option, the assumption is that we are looking at 1 or 2 months of the average bill, which is approximately $250 to $500, so $250 for 1 month, $500 for 2 months, and that the credit would be split between a front-end credit and a back-end credit that's associated with a payment arrangement that is active and is up to date. As we move to residential options on page 11, they're very similar to the commercial options in that this will allow time for our status quo, waiving late fees and no disconnects. This also allows significant federal and state programs to get to customers. Just as Carrie mentioned earlier, we had customers that received some of their stimulus checks. They came down and they paid their power bill. Options 2 and 3 are in both focused on a bill credit for customers in need. The primary difference is, again, is how customers are confirmed that they're impacted. employee due to COVID-19 shutdown. This would include anyone in the household. And this would look at providing documentation for their qualified unemployment insurance. Option three is a wider net. This is letting customers self-certify in the same manner as in the commercial that they have been negatively impacted by COVID-19. This, of course, opens up a much larger population set, and we'll see that during with the expected and estimated cost options, we'll see how that plays out with those. So similar to commercials, in either option, the assumption is that we are looking at a 1 or 2 months of the average bill for residential customers. That's $45 at 1 month or $90 for two, and that the credit would be split between a front-end and a back-end credit associated with the payment arrangement.
Andrew, can I ask a question here?
Absolutely.
And Eric's sitting there, so maybe Eric's the appropriate one. Of those three choices on the residential and even the commercial option, there's not an issue or a concern here that we're using kind of a discriminatory practice, right?
So, Commissioner, I'd rather actually hold that discussion until we have an opportunity to chat offline. There are certainly some concerns about how those options could be perceived by those taking advantage of them. The intent is clearly that whichever of those we selected, we would design the program to address those concerns. Put frankly, even though we have focused on small businesses in the title, because we have one commercial rate class, I think that whatever sideboard you establish would likely make the program available to all commercial rate payers, regardless of size, small, large, something in between, as long as they met the parameters. The parameters are designed to provide assistance to those rate payers, residential or commercial, that have been put in a economically challenged position because of the COVID-19. And the district is not alone in that, and we do believe we have the authority to provide that assistance to those rate payers. So we use some terms in here for description purposes that, depending upon how the program is actually established and rolled out, given whatever feedback the board provides, we would certainly have those issues squarely in mind and design the program to avoid any discriminatory intent.
Thank you, Eric. I wanted you to say that. Thank you.
You bet.
May I ask a question here? This is Dennis.
Go ahead, Dennis.
A couple of them, actually. What I'm hearing is that seems to be at least some spot of separating COVID-19 affected customers from those who may be unemployed or underemployed customers prior to or during COVID-19. As an example, if I'm an underemployed person, let's say a person who's working for minimum wage with a family, I may be working a 40-hour or a 60-hour week, but I don't make enough to always pay all of my bills. Now, also with COVID-19 taking place, there's pretty limited opportunity for me to probably move into a different economic or higher-paying job. And so I'm just wondering how we're splitting this out. You know, is this those affected by COVID-19? Is that our focus, or is this an overall focus to our customers who are having difficulty making ends meet? So that's one question, and I'll hold off on the answer. And the other one is, I think there's going to be a second critical time, and that's when the economy is allowed to start back up. Cash flow is going to be incredibly difficult to manage. If I have been out of business for 3 or 4 months and I need to start my restaurant back up and I am going to start incurring electric bills again. Is there any thought in there in terms of providing opportunity to reduce their need for cash flow to get business back up and going again? So those are my two questions.
Yeah, let me take those. Those are both meaty questions. On the first one, yes, this presentation is really focused on COVID-19 impacts, and that comes out of our conversation at the last board meeting, which said, let's talk more about eligibility and try to understand that. But as I was thinking about this presentation this weekend, I'm realizing that, well, we had a fair amount of discussion at the last board meeting about the fact that the new CETA law in Washington State does encourage us to think about electric bill impacts on low-income customers, and especially on this category that's described as energy burdened, a new concept for us.
Yeah.
And that, yeah. So we know that we need to come back to the energy burden conversation, and candidly, that could happen sooner or later. It probably depends somewhat on the guidance the board gives us today. To the extent that we stay focused on COVID-19, then we, you know, that's just, we only have so much time and staff resources, and so we probably will stay focused there. If the board were to say, okay, so let's focus more on the July timeframe for COVID-19 and wait until we see that we're now dealing with the fact that people have to pay these bills that have accrued, then it opens up some time for us to get back to the energy burden concept. So I think that there is an avenue there to address the type of customer that you're talking about, Commissioner Bowles. And the time frame for that is going to be driven by board direction, I would say, relative to our staff efforts. Do you want me to pause there or move on to the second question?
No, I'm satisfied with your answer. So, yeah, I'd say at least for me, move on, please.
Okay. So with respect to the commercial customers and the difficulties that they may have in restart, I think there are two things that are included here in this proposal that can help to address that. It's a bit vague, but we did have conversation around option one for the commercial customers that in addition to the fact that we have said no cutoffs, no late fees through the end of July, which allows you to defer making your payment until then, that we have the option of potentially extending that period in which we would not require payment. So there is a way to be able to deal with that cash flow problem through the payment terms that we would seek. And you know, that could be a month or two or whatever it might be. Again, that would be something we could talk about with the board. There also is embedded in this concept that Andrew mentioned, but I'd like to focus on for a moment, which is if there is a credit to be given, it could be split between the front end and the back end payment. And what we meant by that is, so our customer service folks would be calling customers, or they'd be receiving calls from customers saying, okay, it's time to begin paying. We're no longer in the no cutoffs, no late fee mode anymore. Back end when you've finished and caught up to your bill. So it was there's an incentive here to agree to a payment plan, and there's an incentive to complete the payment plan. So that also, because of the front end, could help with that cash flow problem. Is that responsive to your question?
Yes, it does. Thank you.
Thank you. Move on to slide 12. Slide 12 and 13 will be our estimates for the options. The first slide 12 is for the commercial, and for option two, our estimate right now is that just over 700 businesses are closed down. We chose the utilization rate of the bill credit that is a guess at this time, and so we saw 730 customers. 75% of those we think might take advantage of the program, and then we have the cost from the 1 or 2 month perspective. Again, the utilization rate right now is, it really is a group took a look at it and thought, that sounds maybe about right. But there's not a lot of science and data on that number. But it is good for a order of magnitude estimate. For option three, our estimate, and again, this is the bill credit to any customer that self-certifies that they're impacted. Our estimate for potentially impacted businesses is around 2,300. This is based on the data presented a couple weeks ago, where we went out and looked at all the businesses. We tried to align as best. the whether they were essential or non-essential, and so we came. This is where that we came up with that 2,300 number. We chose a 50% utilization rate for this option because there's going to be probably some customers in there that you know we might have misidentified or they're open still. They're not as not being impacted as much. And so for both those options, you see a range of around $140,000 to about $575,000. That's based on
we're still going.
The amount of time.
Should be just a minute or two.
And then on the administrative costs, we're going to learn more about those as we go. Do you know that
already?
Our customers provide bill credits now? Our customer relations staff provide bill credits at this time to customers. So that's something that mechanically we can do. And so from a administrative cost perspective, we'll learn more about that moving forward. I'll stop on that. I'll stop on the commercial before I go to the residential for any questions. Okay. Moving on to the residential. The same process was used to estimate costs for the residential options. For option one, we forecasted that in the coming weeks there could be up to 10,000 unemployment claims. You know, there could be more, there could be less. We wanted to take a look out and try to look out into the future just a little bit. Again, we used a 75% of that number that may come and seek the bill credit. For option three, we use our whole customer base, around 38,000 customers, and we guess that 50% of those may seek the bill credit. The cost range for the residential is $340,000 to $1.7 million. The high end is driven by allowing residential customers to self-certify that they have been impacted. And again, utilization rates here were an estimate from the team. There's no numbers behind that at this point in time, but we wanted to put something in there to provide the board with some cost to consider. Have any questions on that slide or how those numbers came about?
So, Andrew, I'm going to jump in and take over for just a moment because we're past time, and I would like to just make a couple of points here. Probably a couple of the numbers we maybe should have included. If the board were to choose option two for both commercial and residential, the cost would range from about $475,000 to $950,000. Again, these are broad estimates. We're guessing at how many people would participate. It's very difficult to display these. In fact, I kind of wish we would have taken the exact numbers off here because it's just a matter of multiplication, not our level of confidence in these estimates. And then if you choose option three, it ranges from about $1.1 million to about $2.3 million in costs.
So, Steve?
Yeah.
This is Randy. And I don't know how much time we're going to want to dedicate to feedback on this, but I've got a lot of feedback.
Yeah, that's exactly where I wanted to go. We really want a lot of feedback on this. And so I would like to just pause for a moment to ask the board, would you prefer to take a break for lunch and come back and get feedback later, or would you prefer to just keep going right now?
Commissioners, what are your wishes?
This is Dennis. I'd like to take a break and come back.
Okay.
Is Steve the same?
Okay. Why don't we, can we, commissioners, is it possible to take a shorter lunch? Can we start, at least, Steve, would that work if we reconvene before 1 o'clock?
We could do whatever you want to do.
Well, I'm thoughtful of staff, if staff would be, if that would work for staff.
Yeah, I'm not too troubled that we can manage the time this afternoon if we just give people notification as to how we would do this. If we started this afternoon, we could. I might suggest that we go through the resolutions. I think they should go relatively quickly, and then we could jump back into this conversation and we could manage the manager items by working with staff on that.
Okay, So why don't we go ahead and stop now? Take. 1 hour break, start it back up at 1 o'clock, and we'll just carry on in the manner that you just described, Steve. Commissioners, is that acceptable?
That works for me.
Yes.
It does for me.
Okay, so, and Steve, does that work for you okay?
Yeah, that works great. We'll let folks know.
Okay, good. Let's take a pause. I would like to make an offer at this moment in time for public comment. I had said earlier today that members of the public would be asked and encouraged to make comment and ask questions, those that might be on the line. Phones will be open now. If you wish to speak, please state your name and address for the record and limit your comments to 3 minutes. Hearing no public comments, we will recess now for lunch and begin our business session at 1 o'clock. To the April 27th, 2020 business session of the Chelan County PUD Commission meeting. I'd like to thank everyone for calling in. And in the spirit of social distancing due to the COVID-19 virus, today's meeting will be conducted by telephone. Members of the public that may be on the phone are encouraged to ask comments, ask questions and make comments. If you wish to speak, please state your name and address and limit your comments to 3 minutes. I will open the phones at the conclusion of our meeting today in order for comments to be had by the public. Now, Steve, we cut short our meeting this morning. Do you want me to move on to the consent agenda, or how would you like me to proceed?
Yes, please.
Okay. Commissioners, we have a consent agenda in front of us. Is there a motion to accept the consent agenda?
I would move approval.
It's been moved. Do I have a second? Do we have a second on the consent agenda?
This is Dennis. I was looking for clarification. That's the consent agenda includes 11, correct?
Yes, the consent agenda would include item number 11. I'm sorry I didn't mention that. That is correct.
Well, and I was speaking with my phone muted, which is probably appreciated, but pretty ineffective.
So I'll take that as a second, Dennis.
Yes, I'll second it, please. Thank you.
You're welcome. So it's been moved and seconded. Is there any questions, comments, discussion? Hearing none, all those in favor say aye.
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 And all those opposed say nay. The ayes have it. Motion carries.
Okay, with that, we are ready to move to the regular agenda. This will be agenda item 10, resolution approving the purchase and sale agreement with Justin and Holly Pickens for the sale of real property and settlement of a property dispute and authorizing the general manager or his designee to complete the transaction. Eric Walquist will present.
Good morning, or I guess good afternoon, Commissioners. Eric Walquist here. So item 10 is a resolution approving a proposed purchase and sale agreement with Mr. and Mrs. Pickens of Entiat, Washington. Commissioners, you'll recall that, you met Mr. Follis several board meetings ago, and Mr. Follis, Mr. Pickens, and another neighbor all find themselves in similar situations with the district, and the district has been working with these customers for quite a period of time to resolve some confusion and some potential disputes regarding some ownership of properties between their properties and the district project boundary up in the Entiat area. Brief background, City of Entiat vacated an old highway that was actually owned by the state and later procured by the district. When these individuals purchased their properties, their title insurance companies apparently insured their property to include the vacated portions of the highway that was later sold to the district. That was a mistake. The district actually owns that property, but realizing that we have these potential disputes out there. We've been trying to work with the customers to get them as much as we can of the property that they thought that they owned or that was insured by their title companies that they believe they'd purchased. So Mr. and Mrs. Pickens is the first of three agreements that the board will hopefully see here in relatively short order, resolving any dispute of this property. If you have the map that was sent to you as part of your materials, you will see that the area outlined in yellow is the disputed area, a little over 6,000 square feet. We are proposing to sell that property to the Pickens for an appraised value of $9,788.04. That will resolve the ownership of that portion of the disputed property outlined in yellow. You will see on the map that there's also some other hashed property that's outlined in a dashed red line or box. That is property that the district must retain, and it intends to do that, although we are providing on the terms that we normally would provide adjacent upland owners the right of use of some of that property for both yard landscaping and dock. So we have separate documents that are not required for board approval because those parameters and those document decisions have already been delegated by the board. So it's kind of a two-step process. We'll be selling the portion that we can and permitting the use of the property that we can't. Important to note that the permitted uses of the property that the district retains ownership of is subject to a annual fee for the use value of the property, which is true in all permitted properties that the district allows use of. And it is subject, that use, to the district's need of that property for inundation, operation, and other business decisions associated with the project there at Rocky Reach. So this is the first of three, hopefully, that will resolve three disputed parcels up in the Eniat area. I'm happy to answer any questions that the board has. Important note that because this is a resolution of disputed issues and interests, it is not subject to the normal process of surplus property and then, I'm going to say, an open call for bids or an exploration of others that might be interested. This is a direct resolution of dispute with the adjacent property owner. You will see, for information purposes, that portions of the Pickens residence or structure is built within the disputed property area. And they did that in reliance upon the title insurance policy that they'd receive, not knowing that it was district property. We have not increased the value of the sale to account for any portion of the structure. That was a particular concern for the Pickens. And there's really no need for the district to increase the value for that, given that we're simply transferring the underlying fee interest in the property at the appraised price. So asking for the board's approval for that today, and happy to answer any questions.
Eric, Randy here.
Sure, Commissioner.
You did say that based on the title company making the error, that Pickens will be made whole.
So it's difficult to say because subjective definitions of whole, quote-unquote, are up in the air, Commissioner. So I do know because I've had discussions with each of the property owners that each of the property owners is in discussion with their title insurers and seeking recovery. In Mr. Pickens' case, he already has, for what would be the underlying value of the disputed property. In some instances, I know that I think that the property owners have come out better. But I think if you ask them, in all fairness, they might have a different perspective, Commissioner, simply because you know, they believe that they owned right up to the project boundary when indeed they did not. And there is different opinions about what the impacted or residual value of the property might be short of that with some intervening ownership like the district. So certainly, Commissioner, yes. The amounts that we are selling these properties for have been, to my understanding, recovered from appropriate insurance companies. I know, for example, Mr. Pickens was represented by counsel retained by one of his insurance carriers. So I do know that from a nuts and bolts appraised value perspective, those discussions and recoveries are underway. Whether or not those property owners believe that would be, quote, full value or full recovery because of whatever residual impact there be, I can't speak to that, Commissioner.
Yeah, and look, and looking at the number, based on the number of years they've had to deal with this, they're not being made whole. So that's personal opinion. So.
Yeah, I think that's a fair assessment of the property owners' perspectives. We are trying to do, as a district, everything we can to get them what we are able to get them within our restrictions and policies, to do as much as we can to make them whole. The rest of that, they will have to, they all have potential avenues for recovery from others, third parties, not the district. I have not advised them on that, and I do not know whether they are all pursuing those additional remedies. Other questions? Thank you, Commissioners.
Okay, with that, I think we have already dealt with agenda item 11, so we'll move to agenda item 12. This is a resolution authorizing amendment number 4 to services agreement SATA number 18-024 with Power Engineers Incorporated to provide GIS ARCFM consulting and implementation. Ray Hani will be presenting. Just recall, Commissioners, this GIS work is really foundational to our entire technology roadmap, and particularly to the automated distribution management system. And I think there was material provided in your book as well that just pulls back up some material that was provided. that was provided a couple of months ago, describing the ADMS technology roadmap. Ray, turn it over to you.
Hello, this is Ray Hani, and I'm a manager in the IT department and project manager of the GIS project. Can you hear me okay?
Yes.
Anyway, just as background, GIS stands for Geographic Information System, and that's the software the district uses for most of their mapping in the water, electric, and fiber and natural resources groups. Anyway, this resolution is requesting an extension to a professional services agreement with Power Engineers for an additional 5 years and an increase in the amount of $900,000. Power Engineers will be providing assistance on the upgrade of the distribution electrical GIS software and migration of the GIS data to a new modernized electrical network model. And as Steve mentioned, this is something that was on the technology roadmap. As more background, our GIS system is provided by ESRI, and which the district has been operating their GIS from ESRI since 1992, and ESRI happens to be the worldwide leader in GIS software deployment. However, ESRI relies on a worldwide network of partners, such as Power Engineers, for doing consulting and services. And Power Engineers has worked with the district since 2004, and they're experts in distribution, electric modeling, and fiber network modeling. So on to the reasons for these GIS upgrades is ESRI is now requiring all their customers to move to a new utility network model by 2024 to stay under support. It's one of these inevitable big changes that come around every, 5 to 10 to 20 years. And this new electrical GIS model will improve electrical analysis capabilities, customer outage management, and integration with the new ADMS and outage management systems, also slated to start this year. Migration of this new data model, though, is complex, and it will require a lot of cleanup of the GIS data, which is a big part of what Power Engineers will be helping with. Well, on to specifics of the resolution is to add $900,000 in additional funds to cover a $400,000 task authorization this year and $500,000 for projected future task authorizations up until 2025. And the future task authorizations will be largely to support integration with the ADMS and outage management effort. And this will bring the total not to exceed amount to $1,370,000, which is also includes some work for the fiber group in there. And onto the customer benefits, this work will benefit Chelan's customers by actively maintaining reliable feeder information about each customer's premise for supporting future outage management and AMI project efforts. And the circuit information maintained by the system will include the customer's feeder ID, their phase, and their nearest upstream protective device or switch. Now, I believe there's a picture in your packet showing how GIS is integrated into the overall ADMS and outage management system effort going on here. You'll see how it's slated to pass the as-built circuit information to the whole integrated system. So I'm asking the commission for approval on this resolution and can entertain any questions.
Commissioners, any questions? I have a question if none of the other commissioners do at this moment, and that really has to do with trying to understand the integration. Is this something that is going to be worked on with our CIS contract software company, or can you explain the integration? And I remember from earlier presentations, our old system, I think the expression that was used had so many new applications hanging off of it that it became a little difficult to work with. So that's really the core of the question is, how does this integrate?
Well, the CIS team has already done their part. When they upgraded CIS, part of that project was providing an integration path into GIS and into ADMS coming up here. So that's basically all ready to go and actually is already actively integrated in the GIS system. So we would just have to basically point it at that same data at the outage management system when we're ready. So we don't have to go back to the CIS team really at this point.
Okay. Thank you.
Any more questions?
Okay, if there are no more, then we are done with the resolutions.
All right. Thank you, Steve. So
I would move approval of resolutions 10 and 12.
Second.
So it's been moved and seconded, approval of resolutions 10 and 12. Do we have any discussion? Hearing no discussion. All those in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, say nay. The ayes have it, and it has been approved. All right. Steve, we're moving on. I think the next on the agenda is the manager items.
This is the point where I would like to suggest that we go back to the conversation that we dropped this morning, and we'd like to have commission discussion around the thoughts that we offered for individuals and small businesses support during COVID-19. And what I would like to suggest is that we start with pages 6, 7, and 8 of that presentation, because what we're trying to do is get to some of the big questions that we think we're confronted with and hear from the board about your thoughts on that. Just as a reminder, those are the questions on how should we help? Should we do something for individuals and small businesses? We heard from one commissioner about that earlier. I might expand that just a bit because we did do some work on eligibility criteria as well. And so if you have any thoughts about the eligibility criteria. Second, the if we provide bill relief, how much? We're saying it's somewhere in the from the small hundreds of thousands up to $2 million coming out of public power benefit dollars. And third, the question of timing. Should we be seeking to put a program in place now or wait until July when the no cutoffs, no late fees is at least currently scheduled to expire, or wait until the fall? Once we get through those, I would like to come back to the specifics around the commercial and industrial options that we propose, but I think it will help us, at least in our thinking, if we could start from this more general level.
Commissioners, any comments that and guidance we can give to Steve?
This is Steve McKenna. So I always be pondering, have a lot of questions on this, but here's some of my thinking at this point and leading up to my recommendation of not waiting till the end of July, because I think it gives us an opportunity. We've already put into place the no cutoffs, no fees, etc. And then we also have the situation where these loan programs, I'd like to see how these loan programs, where their loan is forgiven, that it's my understanding those loans also include utility costs, claims, and, give us the time to see what the requests are, what the needs are, and not rush to making any decisions at this point, but just to see, collect the data on what actually is the need. And that's my feeling and recommendation at this point.
Steve, can I want to make sure that I understand. So your feeling is to wait till July, is that correct?
Yes, it is.
Okay, thank you.
So wait till the end of July.
Thank you.
Steve, this is Ann. What are you looking for right now in terms of feedback? I too have lots of thoughts on this, but I'm not sure we're there yet.
I think that question was probably for me. And so I would say start from the page 6, which describes what we think the board was telling us at the last meeting, and see if that accurately represents your perspective, or at least a combined assessment of perspective from the board. And then page 7 and page 8 get to the questions of is somewhere in the, if we're doing something for COVID-19 relief, is something in the small hundreds of thousands to $2 million the right range for us to be thinking about? And would you believe that we should do something now or wait until July or the fall for beginning to take action in the form of credits on bills?
Okay, thank you. So I think that what you presented accurately reflects, at least in my opinion, what the feedback that we gave to you, 2 weeks ago. And in terms of timing, I agree with Steve McKenna. I definitely don't think we should go out until September. I think people, I think it will give people confidence and help them, help them deal with the stress of being out of work and not being able to pay their bills sooner rather than later. But
So in my opinion, either July or right now.
I'd entertain thoughts and information on both of those.
So this is Randy. I'm glad, Steve, that you guided us back to page 6, because that's where my comments were going to start. The page 6 and the top of page 7, if provide relief, and I'm removing the word bill. If provide relief, how much? I
I'm not terribly comfortable with bill relief, but going back to page 6, I think today's presentation did a good outline of some of the items, but not all of the items. Item 1, need to ensure the assistant helps those in need. I don't know that we can answer that question yet, and based somewhat on what Steve McKenna said, once we get to the end of the day, we may show up that there is not much of a need. And if that's the case, you know, our course going forward is totally different. So for me, the question of if has not yet been answered, if there's going to truly be a need for the COVID response. It very well may be, but it may not. A whole lot of the people that have lost their jobs are, from my experience, a large number of renters. The businesses, small businesses, that has yet to play out based on, like what Steve McKenna said. So I just don't know that we have enough information to make any decision until we get to July. I think July will tell a whole different story. And so the background work we've done here is good work. But I'm not prepared to move forward on anything other than what we've done right yet until that time frame, that July time frame.
Dennis, do you have any comments or thoughts you'd like to share?
I spoke to mine earlier.
Then I guess it's my turn to chime in. As I've been monitoring the economic fallout from various sources and talking with others in the industry that have more of an economic background than I do, and they're sharing their thoughts with me, I'm going to read just a couple of things that hit pretty hard with me as I was pondering this question that we're facing today, and that in the last 5 weeks, unemployment for first-time jobless claims increased 26.4 million. That's 5 weeks worth. We were, by definition, at full employment prior to COVID-19. Some economic advisors are trying to throw numbers out on second quarter GDP and what the contraction might look like, second quarter to first quarter. There tends to be a consensus that it'll be down somewhere 20 to 30% from the first quarter. And one thing that really hit hard, there's a belief, and this is being put forward by a lot of credit card companies and some of the evidence that they're seeing from card users and what they're doing is that some of the most at-risk individuals are using cash advances on credit cards in order to buy food and pay their rent. I do believe some of this will be mitigated by the federal assistance program and unemployment and the checks that are going to be mailed out and received by individuals. But what I take away from all this information in my conversations is this is not a short-term problem. This is going to be a longer-term problem, and the definition of long-term is yet to be decided. So I am going to side with my fellow commissioners with respect to not wanting to rush into it at this point and trying to keep our powder dry for what might still be ahead of us that perhaps could be worse. And there's also an advantage that I see in waiting at least until the end of July, and that is that by then many of those in need will be self-identifying. We'll have a better picture, I think, as Commissioner Smith said, we'll have a better picture of what the need is and who the individuals are that exhibit the need. So I would have to chime in with my fellow commissioners that not rushing forward, let's wait till the end of July. Let's continue to look at the issues. And perhaps even over that time frame, we may come up with some new, more creative ideas that we haven't even thought of yet. But that's where I stand.
Let me. This is Dennis. Oh, go ahead, Dennis.
Go ahead. Well, I was just going to say, and here's a statistic that I think there's 118 people utilizing Helping Hands. Is that up? Is that down? Is that about the same number as usual? Is there anyone that can answer that question?
Carrie, are you on the line?
Yes, I am. Hi, Dennis. We use Helping Hands very little, so definitely this is a high number of Helping Hands. And we will continue to use Helping Hands as we need to in the next couple months as well.
Yeah. Do you know what if there's an average monthly use of Helping Hands up to this point?
It's very low. Probably less than 2,000 a month. Is that what you mean by amount?
Number of people.
Oh, number of customers we help with Helping Hands. It averages between 5 and 10 customers a month.
A month.
Mm-hmm.
And we're at 118 now.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
And that's for March and April.
Okay, combined month. So approximately 60 a month.
Mm-hmm. Correct.
Okay. While I agree with the wait until July mode, and kind of wait and see, I just wanted to take a look at what the immediate need seem to be, and whether that was an indication that there are more people in immediate need than normal, and if so, how many. So, again, just wondering out loud if there's a way to help some identified people through Helping Hands or and then wait until July. So, that's kind of where I guess my questions lie.
Let me take a second to address that. A couple things. So, Carrie, just remind me, the last I saw, there was a little over $85,000 in the Helping Hands account. Is that roughly right?
That's correct. It's less now because we did send another 40, I think I sent another 40 customers last week. So it's down probably to 75,
okay.
70, between 70 and 75.
So the thing that I feel comfortable with is at that level and the numbers that at least Carrie's seeing so far, we should be good for at least a few months with the what's in Helping Hands. Another question came up at a prior board meeting about whether we could whether the district could put money in the Helping Hands program. I don't think we've wrestled that completely to the ground yet, but it doesn't appear to be a pressing issue at the moment. We have enough funds there to be able to address it, and I think Carrie is liberally encouraging folks that have trouble to move forward to Helping Hands. But I would also say that, as I hinted at earlier today, we really focused our efforts these last 2 weeks on the question of if we were going to provide bill relief for COVID-19, how would we put that together? What types of eligibility to try to get that feedback from the board? If the board is headed towards saying, okay, that's good, thank you for that, let's just put that on the shelf for at least a little bit to go see how things play out in the real world, that would create the opportunity for us to return to the question, which we know we need to address ultimately anyway, which is the what do we want to do with energy burden customers. This was the guidance that's provided by the CETA, the Comprehensive Energy Transformation Act, that the utilities are supposed to be looking at energy burden customers. We've got a lot better information as a result of that work that was done for us by Empower DataWorks, and we could turn our attention to that in this interim period and be able to address those customers who are most in need and started out in need over the course of, say, the next 4, 6, 8 weeks while we're waiting to see the data from COVID-19 and its economic impacts on the county. Does that address the question, Commissioner Bowles?
Yeah, the particularly the cash flow at Helping Hands really is a good piece of information. And I guess I would encourage us to move forward to clarify whether we at some point would be, if needed, contribute to that fund, because administratively that really cuts down our handling of it. And they already have a mechanism for screening and recommendations, et cetera. So I think let's keep an eye on Helping Hands for immediate need and what Helping Hands may need. And let's take a look at more of the July and a little bit later. Also, I think keeping, you know, paying attention to the energy burden in a certain hot spot in Schlein County. So, but thank you. That really is helpful information.
You know, I should add one more thing. There's the program that we just haven't discussed today. We did it at the last meeting, the low-income heating energy assistance program, LIHEAP, it's frequently called. Those dollars are available, too, and there will, at least we have been told, there'll be an increase in those dollars available to Chelan County because the money that's coming from the feds to the state and then through the Community Action Council. So that's another thing that we can keep track of, which is how is the usage of the LIHEAP dollars going, and also the availability of LIHEAP dollars. How does that expand through time?
Steve, in line with our discussions today, is it fair to assume that this topic that we're discussing right now will be on the agenda for each of the board meetings right up and through the July timeframe?
Yes. And in fact, if you'd like, I'd take a shot at summarizing what I think I've heard and what the direction is and what we would intend to do as staff. Would this be a good moment for that, or are there any more comments? Hearing none, I think I hear, okay, so some good work has been done here. Appreciate that. But for now, let's put that on the shelf, and we'll come back to it probably in June, I would guess, to review the information about how things are going. We also will continue to operate the program that we are operating, the no cutoffs, no late fees, using Helping Hands, keeping track of the funds that are coming from the LIHEAP dollars that are coming in, just to make sure that we've got our finger on the pulse of what is the need in Chelan County and how is it exhibiting itself in terms of people seeking relief. And we can provide information on that, I would say, at every meeting. The slide that I believe it's slide 4 that we used last time and updated this time. We can just continue to update that in terms of the number of calls that we're getting, the number of folks who are seeking assistance, and how we're doing with respect to delinquent accounts. Does that sound acceptable to the board?
Works well for me.
Yes, it does.
Yes.
Steve, it sounds great. The only thing that I would like to ask is that as we look at slide number 4, one of the questions I had was trying to separate the individuals who habitually are late from those individuals that might be impacted by the COVID-19.
Yes, we'll do. We've got that captured as a follow-up item, and so we will make sure that that's captured and is presented as we go forward with this. Now, I'm going to put a caveat on that, and that's difficult to do, so we're going to try to figure out how to do it and do the best with it that we can.
I think Gary's talking a ballpark number.
Right, you're right, Randy. Just some guidance to help us.
Yep. Yeah, we'll rely on the fact that Kerry does a great job of keeping track of customers and having a good sense of who tends to show up year after year.
that's really tough. I don't know that we can, I don't know that we can even get in the ballpark, maybe, but I just hate to see us dedicate a whole lot of staff time to that. My input.
Well, here's my interpretation of the request, and that's that we're not going to actually go create a system that codes every customer as to whether they are or they are not. We're going to rely on Carrie to give us a percentage estimate and her best view in consultation with her staff as to how many of them are coming in or ones that we've seen before versus ones that are new.
Yes. Thank you.
Okay, if there are no other comments, I really consider this a very successful discussion. It's given us great feedback, and we understand what our assignment is from here. We will also, I should have added, we will spend some time just looking at this energy burden customer issue. We'll get back to that. I'm not sure whether we'll get back to it by the next meeting or not, but we will be looking at that and trying to figure out what's our strategy for how we would address those folks. Again, we needed to do that anyway, so this is just a matter of following through on an action item that existed for us, whether or not there was a COVID-19 issue. With that, I am prepared to turn to manager items. Mike Coleman, are you on the line?
I am, Steve.
Okay, thanks, Mike. You're up first.
Okay, two items, commissioners. One was the bandwidth management within the network. We had previously provided you information regarding some actions we had taken in the very first couple of days of April. The actions were very, very successful. We did some bandwidth management that was affecting the core links. Second, we added 10 gigabits to the primary and backup links from Saddle Rock, doubling the capacity from Saddle Rock. And then in conjunction with that, we moved the primary side of Saddle Rock into a separate link group and terminated it in co-located equipment at Localtel's POP. And what that had the effect of doing was not only relieving tremendous amount of traffic off of the core links in the network, it also reduced the traffic on Localtel's network-to-network interface. And the reason for that is that their network-to-network interface, we had just recently added an extra 10 gigabits per second to it, and it was already starting to rise up to an uncomfortable position. By doing this, we had previously seen Saddle Rock links peaking during the peak hours, very close to 90%, which is a level that makes us uncomfortable. We would like to see the peaks certainly no more than the 60 to 70% range. Once we made these changes, that's exactly what we achieved. The portion that is coming out of Saddle Rock and through the core and through the NNI is stabilized, where we're seeing peaks below 70%, 60 to 65% average. On the new link access group, we're seeing peaks no higher than about 35%. So what we did there was to reduce a potential choke point and eliminate both congestion and latency from those particular links. And it had a secondary effect, of course, which was known up front, that it would also move traffic off of the core and allow the core to not impact beyond a certain level. So we viewed all of that as very, very successful. The second topic, well, let me stop there and see if there are questions.
No questions, but kudos.
Thank you. So I'll go to the second topic, which are the hotspots. You had approved them back on the 13th of April, and we had hoped to have them up in 7 to 14 days. It's been just a wee bit slower than that, but as of today, There are four of them up. Three are confirmed working. The fourth one is scheduled to absolutely finish this afternoon. Those are located across the county. There is one in Wenatchee. It's up Squilchuck Road by the Beehive Grange. The next one is at Albin Drive in Eniat. That's the Chelan County Housing Authority building. Third one is at on Riverside Drive in Cashmere, and that would be the Cashmere Riverside Center. The fourth one, which they were waiting on a power supply to be replaced today, is in Leavenworth up on Highway 2, 694 Highway 2, and that's at the Leavenworth lot, P5 by the pool. So all of these appear to be very, very good locations. We're going to be very interested to monitor the usage on them and see both how many people and exactly how much usage these are getting. I will tell you that the service providers are looking at them, and specifically, as with any public open hotspot, they're trying to make sure that the hotspot is being used so that it's not the bandwidth's not being consumed by casual purposes. In other words, they're being used for the reasons that they were put out there. So they're looking at how exactly do they manage them? How do they limit somebody from just sitting there and streaming a Netflix movie, for instance? We don't know that there's any concerns in that area, but it's something that they are taking precautions on from the beginning. We do have other locations that the service providers are waiting on some equipment, and we should see them going up in the next few days to a week. I think the equipment availability for some of the service providers is probably going to dictate their schedule, but they're all committed. There's good communications between our team and all of the service providers, and they are moving as fast as they can move. So any questions?
Mike, this is Randy. I know there's going to be public awareness that, created through our, Kim and Neil. But if a casual person comes by, what are they going to see on their, what's the Wi-Fi hotspot going to look like on their phone or their iPad?
Randy, I think the answer to that may depend somewhat on which service provider put the hotspot in. And second, the access method that they chose to use, which would generally be a splash screen. The other thing is that we are having, in addition to getting these sites on our website, plus working to get an interactive map out there, we're going to have signage put up at each one of the hotspots. And so they will be able to look for that in the general area that the map shows.
Mike, this is Gary, and I have a question for the Chelan County Housing Authority down in Malaga. Do you know what the what kind of strength does that signal have? There's going to be, of course, lots of folks down in that area, and I would anticipate a lot of those folks are going to be using this.
Gary, the one that I mentioned that's active is in Eniac.
Oh, it's in Eniat.
It is in Eniat. There are several locations in Malaga to include the fire station, which was recommended to us, as well as some of the other public buildings. And I will have to find out when that will be in the schedule.
Okay. Thank you.
And Mike, would you take one more second, because the term hotspot covers a wide variety of capability, and would you describe the capability associated with our hotspots compared against some of the other ones that are smaller in nature?
Yes, and that's a very good suggestion, Steve. Hotspot's a widely used term, and it can have a number of different meanings. This will also allow me to go back and answer Gary's question, which I forgot at the end of that. So if you look at a hotspot, it could be a small cellular device that's considered a hotspot. In our case, these are actually full-blown wireless access points, but commonly they're also called hotspots. We did allow the service providers to utilize the equipment of their choice, what they had, what they're familiar with, or what they're using in other places. And so they're putting in a wireless access spot, wireless access point that is enabled by either a 100 megabit per second or a gigabit per second circuit. So there's a lot of capacity at these points. As a general rule with that type of equipment, you're probably going to see a 200 to 300, maybe 350 foot service radius. There are hotspots that put out more power, but that is problematic when you've got them in a built-up area, whether it be Malaga, Wenatchee, or Leavenworth, because of interference issues. So they're using a standard type configuration, and it'll give about that 200 to 300 foot serving area.
I stopped in Washington and was starving. All they had was a big loaf of white bread.
Commissioners, I'd like to remind everybody to mute your phone. We can.
So I believe I got your question there, Commissioner Arsenault, and also describe those differences, because if somebody's using a cellular hotspot, it is relatively low bandwidth, and it handles very, very few devices. These hotspots will handle a significant number of users, and they have plenty of bandwidth to do that. As we see the usage materialize, both the number of users and the bandwidth, then it could be that we turn that circuit up from 100 meg to a gig, simply to enable more capacity.
Thank you, Mike. I appreciate that. What caught my ear, of course, was a housing authority, you know, where you have a denser population and an expectation that there might be greater usage there. But thank you. That explains it. Thank you.
Certainly.
Okay. Thank you, Mike. If there are no other questions, I'm going to move to Kelly and team on the bond issue pricing results.
Before we go on to that, Steve, one, Mike, I want to thank you for, you know, working with in school districts. What I've learned over the last couple of weeks is, particularly with districts, how they're working with many different places to get access points. I've been asked not to use the word hotspot, because that's confusing to people with the virus as to we're not really creating virus hotspots, we're creating Wi-Fi access points. So I've been trying to do a better job with that as I talk to school districts. But I've had some interesting requests, and I just wanted to run this by my fellow commissioners because it kind of goes against what my thinking originally, where some drive up in their car, access, and then leave, and the school district folks telling me that what's actually needed are supports, which kind of flies in the face of social distancing, but we've got kids that are riding in their bicycles, kids that are walking up out of the woods, so I've also been asked, do we have availability of some tables, or can we use some power benefit dollars to purchase some tables or rent some tables, that because not everybody coming to access this is in a car. They don't have a place to sit. Kids carrying laptops, they're dropping them on the ground. They really need a table, and the districts would put up some signage that, you know, to promote social distancing. You don't want a group of kids sitting at a table, but it's usually one or two kids at a time coming up, sitting down to access, do their homework, and leave. So I just thought that was very interesting. Wanted to get my fellow commissioners' take on that and see if they put that out there. Does anybody have any solutions? I think it's a challenge. Another challenge we're facing is.
Hey, Steve, this is Randy, and I'm not prone to instantaneous feedback. I got to think about that one for a while because we automatically elevate the cost and the maintenance. But I had an old term that you may not have heard much of. That requires soak time on my part.
Yes, and I think that's what I was asking for, is just give this some thought and see if anybody's got any solutions, because it was completely out of context of how I envision people coming to use this, and the reality may be something different than what I originally thought. So maybe I just throw it out there and let people think about it. Thank you.
Okay, let me pause for a second, just ask if there are any more comments. Okay, Kelly, turning to you.
This is Heather Ireland, lead treasury analyst for the district. Can you hear me okay?
Hear you good, Heather.
Great. So I wanted to go ahead and provide a summary of the district's bond sale results from last Tuesday, April 21st. The district was able to sell $133.8 million of refunding and new money bonds on Tuesday. The bonds will refund the district's 2009D Build America bonds, as well as our 2009A Rocky Reach and Rock Island Environmental Enhancement bonds, and a portion of our 2008B variable rate bonds. In addition to those refundings, there's also a portion of the bonds that are for new money. We will actually receive proceeds for available for construction of $103 million, and that's planned to be used over the next 2 to 3 years for long-lived capital assets, including a portion of our new service and operations center, and also distribution system expansion projects such as substations. The rates on the refunded bonds were approximately 5%, while the yields to maturity on the new bonds that we were able to issue range from 1% to 3%. The blended all-in interest cost is just under 2% on the new bonds. With the new issuance and considering other planned debt reductions, the district's overall debt portfolio net present value savings are estimated to be approximately $20 million. That net present value is calculated using an industry standard practice of comparing the prior debt service cash flows to the new debt service cash flows, and then discounting those cash flows back to today using a rate based on the new bonds. The district will realize those savings gradually over the life of the bonds through approximately 2039. Originally, when the board approved the plan of finance to move forward with exploring this process, we are anticipating being able to achieve a $10 to $15 million net present value savings. So we were able to get into the market at the right time and achieve good results for the district at approximately $20 million of savings. The bond sale itself went very well for the district. there were approximately 26 different accounts of institutional buyers that submitted orders. This is a relatively robust number, which may have been helped by the fact that the district had not issued bonds recently, which therefore can make our bonds attractive to buyers for diversification purposes. We also have high-quality credit and are an essential service utility provider, which is attractive in the current market environment. That large number of attention actually enabled us to complete the sale at slightly lower yields than we had planned. There were 6 local selling group members that completed the participation process, although no retail orders from the 4-county area were ultimately received. We were happy to provide the opportunity, and overall, the result for the district of the new bond issuance was very successful.
Well, thank you, Heather, for the overview. This is Kelly, and I did want to kind of close our comments by recognizing Heather and also Debbie Litchfield for their leadership and perseverance in this bond issue that we did. As you may guess, it was a roller coaster ride with trying to navigate the current markets. You know, we made this, we started this last year. The board made the first go, no-go decision back in December, and then confirmed that in March. So our timing was just right to hit the all the turmoil in the markets and all the impacts of COVID-19. But both Debbie and Heather provided that steady leadership. They were both really confident that if we could hang in there and be ready to go when the markets were ready to kind of get back to normal and accept new bonds into the market, that since we are such a quality credit, that we could really do achieve our goals that we wanted to with this refunding and new money issue. So thank you to Heather and Debbie for your courage and your perseverance to place us right at the right time so we were able to achieve this. And then we also had a really good external team that gave us advice along the way and supported us, including Barclays, PFM, and ORIC. So all of us together were able to persevere and follow through on this so that we could reach our ultimate goals of the savings overall and the new money. So good job, Heather and Debbie.
Okay, on that wonderful news, we're ready to move on to our next item. Thank you to the finance team. Devin Myers will describe the design build process that we're planning to use for an upcoming Rock Island Powerhouse 2 project.
Thank you, Steve. This is Devin. You can hear me, I assume?
Hear you good.
Okay, thank you. Yeah, I'm Devin Myers. I'm a project manager here at the district working down at Rock Island on the Powerhouse 2 rehabilitation projects. We currently have 2 balance of plant projects down at Rock Island that we are thinking of using the progressive design build process for both of these projects. And you may be aware, but this progressive design build process is the same process we're using for the Powerhouse 2 generating unit rehabilitation project. The 2 projects that I'm referring to, or one of them is the generator main lead replacement project that has an estimated value of between $4 and $6 million, and also the draft tube gate cylinder and hydraulic power unit upgrade, which is estimated between $6 and $7.5 million for that project. These projects are scheduled as part of the total rehabilitation of Powerhouse 2. And as we get into the design build process, originally we are scheduled to complete these projects in 10 years hand in hand with the unit rehabilitation. But one of the benefits of using design build is that we potentially could save the district money and time by having different ways of scheduling this work to get it done maybe in the next 4 to 5 years. So some of the benefits of design build would be to have those conversations with the finalists selected for this project. to use a design-build process, the district has to follow statutory regulations laid out in RCW 39.10.300, and some of these, we have to meet at least one of the following. The statutory threshold for the design-build is $2 million per project, and we meet that one. So, boom, we're done. But there's others, and the construction activities are highly specialized. I think that could be said about both of these projects. That there's only certain people out there that would be able to do this kind of work, and which plays into the next one, where both projects provide opportunity for greater innovation and efficiencies, and that is part of the also part of the design build process, is that we get to actually speak with these potential contractors and together develop better ways of doing what we've done in the past. There has been talk about if using design build is way more labor intensive. I think that just stems from the first time we've used it was for the Powerhouse 2 rehabilitation, which is a big, very technical project, and it has taken some time to do it right. I think we're doing it right, so I would agree with that. But some of the expected benefits are that the time spent developing the RFQ and the RFP, so this would be the request for qualifications and the request for proposal, is the same as the time you would spend developing, designing and developing technical specifications. And also resources are shifted to be used up front in the planning, project planning, and therefore less in the project execution when you get to that portion of the project. And then also one of the biggest benefits I think we have seen so far is that you develop relationships with the selected design builder during the RFP process, but also during the negotiation that takes place after one is selected. And through that relationship, this should minimize things down the road like change orders, budget revisions, and major schedule impacts. Of course, these will be things that we'll be testing and tracking as we do these two projects and you know, get a better understanding of the cost-benefit ratios as we do lessons learned as we get through these two projects. So where we're going with them next, we have to go to use design build, you have to go to the state project review committee, and we have applications that we've submitted last month or this month on the 20th, and then we will be showing up May 28th to present both of these projects to the state PRC. Some of the questions that will be asked at that point in time will be, does the district support these projects? And the way that we answered that in the past and we'll be able to answer again is that our capital budget, which was approved in 2017 for the Powerhouse 2 rehabilitation project, included this project. And also, and continues as part of the, with the current budget forecast. The other part of that is that I will be coming back to the board on May 11th to request authorization to advertise both of these RFQs. So that's what we'll be able to explain or tell them on May 28th that the district does support both projects. Are there any questions? I kind of went through that kind of fast, I feel like.
Commissioners, Devin, this is Eric Walquist. I just wanted to correct a slight interpretation in the statute. So RCW 3910-300, Devin's right. The cost of the project needs to be over $2 million. It's not, though, just $2 million and you're done. It's total project cost over $2 million and where one of the three following, so either, okay, as Devin mentioned, highly specialized design-build approach, or greater innovation, or significant savings in project delivery time. So I actually agree with Devin. I think we're clearly over $2 million, and we probably meet each of those subsections as well. Just want to make sure the record's clean.
Yeah. Thank you, Eric. That is true. And I guess I kind of went over the last one, too, the significant savings in project delivery time and realization. I guess one of the things that I'm that we're really looking forward to in this design build process this time is innovative ways to schedule and get this work done. When we originally started looking at it, I know that when you have a project like this, that each chunk or each unit of this project is probably 8 to 12 weeks worth of work for each unit. So when you try to do a 10, 11 year contract and get a contractor to come back and work for 2 months every year, it becomes expensive and difficult, and consistency of the workforce and consistency of getting the same equipment and things like that gets more difficult. So part of the design build process will be asking the potential design builders to give us innovative schedules and ways of doing this work quicker. And we'll be working with them because we do have maintenance overhauls and other types of things like that where we could tie some of this work in and get it done much quicker. So it's hard to do when you do design, bid, build. When you just throw a spec out on the street and say, give us your lowest price, it's hard to have those kind of conversations and narrow in on getting the work done the best we can.
Any questions, commissioners? Okay, you can probably tell that our confidence in these alternative contracting mechanisms is growing as we begin to apply it to more projects, and so you'll be seeing more about this at the next board meeting. Next up,
thank you very much.
Yeah, thank you, Devin. Next up, I want to ask Mike Bradshaw to give an update on what's going on in the energy markets, COVID-19 activity.
All right. Good afternoon. This is Mike Bradshaw, term trader for energy planning and trading. I have just a few slides I want to go over. I think you start in page 75 of your packet. And I guess this will be just like an informational briefing on what are some of the highlights and what's going on. And so on the first slide there, you see there's about six different topics here. Just wanted to touch on. You may have read some headlines about oil prices dipping below zero. I want to talk about natural gas, that those two are interrelated. Does that have any impact on the natural gas landscape? Demand destruction, loads being reduced because of stay-at-home orders. What kind of delays that's posing for new resources looking to come online? And then ultimately what's happening up here in the Northwest in our wholesale power market. So taking a look at mid-sea prices. So second slide. History making. This graph on the left is from 1983 to recent times. And so you can see on the far right, we had the prompt month contract, which would be May, settled, closed a day before it expired at -$37. First time we've seen the WTI prompt month contract closed below zero. So just a huge oversupply situation. Before the COVID-19 shut-ins and the reduced demand from driving and just in the industry in general, you had the Middle East and Russia going at it, not wanting to back down their production, which is going to put downward pressure on prices. You had that going on before the pandemic. And so really, it's just running out of storage. There's really no place to store all this oil that's not being used. And so you're seeing that reflected in the prices. I'll note that June contract is up to $10 right now. And so it's rebounded back to above zero, but just a ton of uncertainty in the market and what might play out. Along with oil production shut-ins, you also have a lot of associated gas that is pulled out of the ground with a drilling for oil. And so oil and gas prices are correlated. And so the next slide, slide three, is just a snapshot of how gas prices are responding. So the graph on the right is the last couple years of the front month contract for natural gas, with the blue line showing as 2020. So you can see we're, and as we reported in the past, we're just in a very low price environment for natural gas when you look at it against history. So again, there's a lot of volatility, a lot of uncertainty with things.
Mike?
Yeah.
Randy Smith here. Looking at that blue line,
it started in January excessively low based on the previous 2 years. Was that already the beginning of a reduced demand from China, or was that just something different?
You know, it's been that way, as you can see, back in the middle of 2019. It's just been very bearish signals. Almost every signal you look at for natural gas pricing, you had a lot of efficiency gains, and you had a lot of production, a lot of gas in storage. So you have the fundamentals of just the simple supply and demand and the mild weather, not needing to pull gas out of the ground to run it for power. You had all that in play in before leading up to this. So really it's been kind of a long time leading up to it, just the basic fundamentals.
Yeah, thank you.
Yeah. So you can see that little blip up on the far right in the blue line. That was kind of the response. Again, there's a lot of uncertainty. I think it gained about 25 cents, which as a percentage of $2 is pretty big. But when you look at it overall, it's not a huge response. There's still just a lot of bearish factors in the future for natural gas. So even though you may have a reduction in pulling gas out of the ground because oil will not be looking to pull as much out going forward with the prices, you still have just a lot in storage and just not a lot of demand, obviously. And the COVID-19 pandemic obviously is reducing the demand there too. So, and with that, I was going to flip to the next slide. This is slide 4, or not slide 4, probably 79 in your packet. Looking at demand destruction, how much has load come off? How much less demand is there for energy? And there's lots of different numbers being thrown around. I think a lot of entities are scrambling and news articles are scrambling to get a number out there. So this is a newsletter that we subscribe to. And in that orange box on the left, you see they're pegging the Northwest demand in the 3-5% range of reduced demand because of the COVID-19. It's going to be different in every location that you look. I think New York was closer to 12-15%, which is kind of what you're seeing in California. But just as a general sense, that's kind of what we're looking at for the reduction in our demand up here in the Northwest. And you can see that showing up here in the solid red line in the graph. That's the actual load. And if you compare that against the orange forecast, that was a pre-COVID-19 load forecast. So you can see that red line is quite a bit lower than that orange line. So the next slide. We talked about demand going down. You also have, on the supply side, a lot of new resources that we're planning and still are planning to come onto the grid could be at risk or delayed. And so you have up to 25 gigawatts of wind energy that's at risk. And then in the storage side of it, the batteries, 62% are already experiencing delays, and 37% said they anticipate setback for 6 months or longer. So you kind of have both sides. You have demand going down, you have supply potentially being delayed or at risk. This is important. The delays are important because a lot of these in the queue for new resources are wind and solar, and there's tax incentives for those, and they start to trickle down starting at the end of this year. So a lot of these projects are very interested in getting construction going in this year to qualify for the largest tax credit. And then ultimately, kicking it back up here to the mid-C, wholesale power prices, this is the last slide here. You can see this is a graph on the right, which is beginning of March through last week, and really not a lot of variability. This looks pretty typical when you look at how prices change day-to-day through time. You have Q3 and Q4 on top there. That's Q3 is like summertime, Q4 would be the wintertime, April, May, June down below. And so you do see some small dip there between March 17th and March 24th, but rebounds pretty quickly back to kind of where it was to start with. So we haven't really seen that trickle through up here in the Northwest. And that's really what I wanted to talk about today. Is there any questions?
Commissioners, any questions?
All right, Mike, thank you very much. Appreciate that update. We have one more item that I would like to cover, and that goes back to Agenda Item 7. There's a page at the beginning there on COVID-19 support that talks about what we're doing to support the healthcare community. Wanted to make sure the board is aware that we are out trying to find ways to be able to support community activities to try to reduce the spread of COVID-19 infection, believing that that will actually help our workforce too, because obviously we're a part of the community, but also a community good that we can provide as well. Couple things that we're doing. Number one, we've provided public information officer support to the Chelan Douglas Health District. They did have a lack of resources there, and we're using Suzanne Hartman, who is under contract to us, to provide that support. She's been very active, and you probably have seen a lot of CDHD activity, and a lot of that can be traced back to Suzanne. What we are working on right now is there has been a lot of discussion about how the economy gets reopened at the national level, at the state level, and certainly some discussion here in Chelan County as well. A few things that are needed, certainly a decline in the infection rate to begin with, substantially more testing, and then once the testing begins to turn up folks, increased contact tracing. So being able to say if someone has been identified as confirmed positive, identify their contacts and encourage them to go into self-quarantine. We have spent time with the Chelan Douglas Health District, and they have identified that they are able to cover the current load that they have with the workforce that they have, but they anticipate that that load is going to increase substantially in the coming weeks and months. And they have been concerned about whether they could provide enough contact tracers. So we spent time with them to understand what does it take to become a contact tracer, and then also trying to find ways to be able to make that process more efficient. We have a project manager from Sapir that is under contract to us, who is now supporting that effort. They have mapped the process, and we will also be providing some of our folks who are currently unable to perform their work remotely are being offered, in effect, to become contract tracers, particularly in the beginning, to be able to test the process and understand it so that from a project management standpoint, we can make sure that we have a really good grasp of how it works and then provide some alternatives for them that would hopefully allow them to better automate the process. Process mapping was concluded at the end of last week, has been shared with CDHD, and they're reviewing it now, and hopefully we're going to be able to get our first folks through the testing process sometime this week. And we've identified about 10 folks internally who we think have the capability to be contact tracers, and we could offer them up, at least for now, without an impact on productivity for the district. A final area I'd want to talk about is just testing. Testing is another area that is clearly necessary, or at least has identified those who are experts as necessary to be able to reopen the economy. We've been active in trying to understand what it would take. The Confluence has the machines to be able to do the testing. They lack the reagents, which are the chemicals that you use to be able to test a nasal swab to determine whether there's virus present. That reagent has been difficult to find. It's a national problem, even an international problem. So we've been advocating both at the state level but also through our national trade associations to try to get greater focus on the need for reagents. We also have been focused on when testing occurs to create priority for the most critical utility workers. So the CDC guidance, unfortunately, does not identify critical infrastructure workers as priority for testing. And again, working with our National Trade Association, we're trying to get that moved up in terms of priority. Our belief is that we could have as many as 100 people who are mostly in the operational side of the business, who could be doing work that that may be necessary to be done, and it is not possible to do it within the social distancing guidelines. And if that were true, then we would like them to be tested on a regular basis to try to identify whether there is an infection risk of some kind. A final point I'll make is we also have been communicating with folks in the agriculture industry about some of the issues there, about migrants coming to the county, and the potential risk associated with that. I would say that generally what we're hearing is that risk is probably mostly due to housing limitations and putting number of folks into smaller spaces or living quarters. And so there have been some questions about are there any things that we can do, making space available possibly for temporary housing. We're looking at that option just to see if there's anything that we could do. So we're trying to stay engaged with the community broadly and looking for ways that we can be contributors to helping to reduce risk across the county and then specifically for our workforce. Open to any questions about that?
Steve, I just want to say job well done. Appreciate all your efforts reaching out to the community and being visible. Appreciate that. Thank you.
Thanks. You know, I should have made one other point. It was made in the package earlier, but I wanted to make sure it was highlighted here. We have not spent a lot of money so far on this. We have created task order assignments that could commit us up to about $100,000 to support this. And we have been thinking about it as public power benefit dollars. We have not we haven't been through a normal process here in terms of bringing it to the board for pre-approval. They're really we felt that we needed to move. So I just wanted to make you aware that's the way we're thinking about it. And if there are any questions or concerns about that, let us know now or let us know over the course of the next couple of weeks. Okay, thank you. And we are finished with manager items.
All right, well, commissioners, we're moving on to commissioner items. Do we have any commissioner that would like to introduce a commissioner item?
This is Randy. I'm sure everybody's aware. I mean, we've all received notification that our national APPA conference has been transformed from an in-person to an online conference. And just FYI, it is my intention to attempt to see what a national convention for 3 full days online will look like. And so I won't say anybody to join me, but to sit in front of your computer for 3 days and probably hear some good speakers, but it'll be very, very different. But all the awards will be given. And so I just wanted you to be aware that was my decision. I hadn't shared that with anyone.
Thank you for sharing, Randy. Has any other commissioner given thought to attending the virtual APPA conference?
This is Steve. I gave my comments to Lisa that I would be attending as well. I'd give it a try.
And I think I will as well.
You're all ahead of me. I was sitting on the sidelines waiting to get more information as to content. But having heard that 3 of my esteemed colleagues are going to be on there, I that kind of pushes me over the edge. So I'll let Lisa know as well. Thank you.
And I think I'll wait and hear the summary.
Uh, So if there are no more commissioner items, let's move on to the follow-up of delegation action items.
Okay, we have a couple from the last board meeting. Eric and Rebecca have been working on a way to be able to get commissioner signatures electronically, and you should have received some information about that on Friday. I think, if I understand right, Rebecca, you're ready to do a test with each of the commissioners to see if that will work?
I am. If anyone wants to test out that process, just let me know, and after the meeting, I will assign the documents to you.
Rebecca, I'll be a good guinea pig here. Let's talk after the meeting.
Okay.
And I'm willing to give it a try, too.
Randy. Yes, this is Steve, and I'm willing to try, and I think I did what I needed to do to in advance to be willing to. Was there something we're supposed to do? We're supposed to sign that and get that all ready. Is that correct?
Yeah, if you upload your signature first, it should be a lot smoother process rather than trying to add that signature each time.
So I think I did that, and so I'm willing to give it a try, too.
Great.
If you're willing to hold my hand virtually, I am willing to give it a try.
Always.
Okay, good. So hopefully by the next board meeting we'll have a sense as to how well that works. We have one other item regarding average commercial bills broken out by small and large customers. I think we need to do a little bit more work on that one. So we'll hold that over till the next board meeting. And I think that's it for our delegation of action items.
Okay, and delegation of action items from today?
So Rebecca will add to the board workshop agenda to review the COVID-19 impacts on district performance plan and how we characterize that. Catherine Willard will provide some additional hatchery information, Skaha hatchery information to Commissioner Congdon, or at least have a conversation about that, follow-up conversation. We're going to have Carrie provide some information on the past due accounts, how many are one-time past due versus multiple past due notices. So we'll try that out at the next board meeting as part of that summary report about the number of calls that we're getting. And Mike will provide commissioners info when additional hotspots are activated. And then we actually have one for Rebecca and you, which is to follow up on the trying out the signature, the electronic signatures.
Great. Good. Good.
Did we miss anything?
This is Steve. Just as a follow-up, not only for commissioners, but see that if you guys have any thought on a request from school districts for walk-up people to our Wi-Fi access points with tables, if anybody has thoughts or concerns, or, you know, it would be nice to hear that.
Okay, so that one is I'm not sure we've ever had one of those before. That's a request from commissioners to get back to a commissioner, so we'll keep track of it, but we'll wait to hear from you guys.
Well, and not only requests from commissioners, but your thoughts or staff thoughts on, you know, it's a different way to think about those.
Warning about it.
On their mind. If you do wish to speak, please state your name, your address for the record, and please limit your comments to 3 minutes. Rebecca, would you open the phone up to anyone?
We're all good.
Thank you. Hearing no comments, are there any matters of general business that may be necessary to come before the commission? Hearing none. Steve, will we need an executive session today?
No, actually, we are good. We do not need one today.
All right. Well, if there are no more comments, then I believe that we shall stand adjourned.